You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Talk Nation Radio.
Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson.
It's my great privilege to welcome to Talk Nation Radio this week Vijay Prashad. He is professor of international studies at Trinity College in Hartford, Connecticut. He is the author of over 20 books, most recently The Death of the Nation and the Future of the Arab Revolution. He reports regularly for Frontline and The Hindu in India, Birgun in Turkey, and Alternet in the United States. He is the chief editor of Leftward Books in New Delhi. Vijay Prashad, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Thanks a lot, David.
Thanks for coming on. I've got the flu at the moment. I'm going to let you do most of the talking here. You've got a number of wonderful articles recently on Alternet, which is where I read them, including one about the rehabilitation of George W. Bush war criminal. Is that for real? Are people who oppose George W. Bush somehow now approving of him?
Well, David, let's go back to the beginning of the Obama administration. It's not really a question of now. It's a question of then. You might remember that Mr. Obama's political career skyrocketed when he opposed the war against Iraq. You know, he made a speech in Chicago as a state senator, took a very strong position against the Bush war against Iraq, and, you know, said that it was because of that that the United States, in fact, was not as safe, perhaps, as it could be. In other words, he took on the Republicans on the grounds of national security. And, you know, he gained a lot of support for that. People were quite impressed by him. Well, right after winning the presidency, Mr. Obama essentially basically gave the entire Bush administration amnesty. You know, at no point was there an attempt to open an investigation into the lies that led, you know, to the destruction of Iraq. At no point was there any call for an investigation on the torture regime, on the question of Guantanamo. You know, he said, I'm going to close Guantanamo, but he never said, let's go back and look at the culpability of people in the Bush administration in the violation not only of American law, but international law. I mean, you know, this might sound maybe slightly cranky for people, but we have to remember that the UN Secretary General, Kofi Annan, called the Iraq war an illegal war, which means, of course, technically, if you take him seriously, take his language seriously, if somebody prosecutes an illegal war, well, the prosecutor of that war is then a war criminal, and there should at least be an investigation. In Britain, to the credit of the government that followed the Blair government, and, you know, I'm talking about the parliament more than the prime minister, they pushed for an inquiry, and there was an inquiry into the lead-up of Britain's involvement in the war. I'm not saying that that inquiry was as good as I'd like it to have been, but at least there was an inquiry, and former Prime Minister Blair had to come to the table and sit down and answer questions. Mr. Obama gave, as I said, amnesty to George W. Bush and people around him. And now, of course, there's a kind of cultural amnesty being provided to George W. Bush. You know, there are these stories that have been trafficking about how George W. Bush and Michelle Obama are best friends. They like each other. She likes his sense of humor. You know, he's been on tour with a book of paintings that he's done of war veterans. And I watched a series of these interviews, and I was quite startled that none of the so-called journalists that interviewed George W. Bush asked him some basic questions. For instance, these are portraits of Iraq war veterans who have been badly, you know, damaged by that war. But there's no painting of Iraqis from that war, including civilians who died tragically in that war. There are no paintings of U.S. soldiers who died. So, you know, this is a whitewash of the Bush legacy. If he received legal amnesty in 2009, he is now receiving a kind of cultural amnesty. I think that's very unfortunate.
I think you have a very good point. I think we should add to the account of Obama's career that as soon as he got into the Senate, he voted to fund the wars over and over again, and after he became president, continued the wars and started new ones. And if we look at the transition from Bush to Obama to Trump, we see a steady and predictable progression in terms of presidential powers to launch wars without Congress, make laws without Congress. I mean, Bush at least went through the formalities of lying to Congress and asking Congress for a vote and so forth. So, you know, there are certain sort of reasonable ways in which people might look back to Bush as a mass murderer, but as you know, things having gotten worse since Bush because of letting him off the hook.
You know, it's a funny thing, David, that this is not just the sequence of Bush, Obama, Trump. You know, there's a way in which, because things keep seeming to get worse and worse, that you develop nostalgia for what came before. So there was a time when people look back, and I'm talking about liberals, looking back at Reagan even, and Nixon, you know, and saying that, look, Nixon at least was in favor of national guaranteed income.
Yeah.
You know, if Richard Nixon's platform was put forward today, he would, to some extent, be to the left of the Democratic Party.
That's right.
So things have progressively gotten so much worse that there is this tendency to look back at previous people and say, you know, maybe they weren't so bad after all. I think this is an indictment of the kind of slippery slope, you know, down which the American polity is traveling.
Yes, I don't think we should say, you know, the current state of affairs is bad, therefore a previous state of affairs was good. It just may have been less bad in some ways. But I wonder if part of the willingness to rehabilitate George W. Bush is based on the fact that although he was more murderous and killed more people far off in distant lands, he's thought of as less racist, less misogynistic, less of a buffoon even than Trump.
You see, this is a dangerous proposition. And I think the idea that Trump should be defined by his stupid tweets or his rhetoric or his really inability to put a full sentence together, I think this is a dangerous game to play, because it fails to look at the records of these people. You know, yes, right after 9/11, Mr. Bush was under pressure to say that all Muslims aren't bad, we're not, you know, in a war against Islam. But there were winks and nods even at the time. And you'll remember that at the time, there were these mini scandals of a general speaking in Colorado talking about a crusade. Bush himself using the language of crusade. And then by 2006, Bush started using the phrase, you know, radical Islamic extremism, which is a phrase that the Republican right seized on and used that phrase to bash Obama and to bash Hillary Clinton, saying, why can't you say this phrase, radical Islamic extremism? Everybody knew when they used that phrase, what they really mean is Islam. They indict Islam. And that is why King Abdullah II of Jordan has for, you know, the last 10 years or so been cautioning the Americans, saying, you know, you are using this inflammatory rhetoric. It's making it difficult for your allies in the region to operate against groups like ISIS, etc. And I was quite stunned to hear Rex Tillerson, the Secretary of State, at a meeting of the 68 countries and organizations that are part of this anti-ISIS coalition, Secretary Tillerson quoted from King Abdullah II. You know, so here you have the kind of buffoonish things that Trump says, etc., but he is within the consensus of, you know, oscillating between fiery rhetoric against Islam, racist language, and then at the same time, you know, this kind of sober language that they talk among each other. So what I'm saying is, you'll remember that when George W. Bush was the governor of Texas, he made some really nasty statements, racist statements, and then callous statements about people that he was executing. You know, a disabled person was being executed, and he was, you know, snickering and making jokes. That's not so different than the, you know, the kind of horrible display for Mr. Trump when he made fun of a differently abled reporter, you know, in one of his campaign stuff. But we forget this. We forget that George W. Bush did exactly the same thing as the governor of Texas. So I think there is this way in which to protect ourselves from the terribleness of the present, we manufacture a more positive past. And I mean, I can understand that. I see why people do that. It's because you don't want to believe that, you know, this is a historical dynamic. You want to believe it's an aberration. And if it's an aberration, then it will go away. You know, if it's a historical dynamic on the other side, you have to uproot it. You have to struggle very hard to make sure that this doesn't have an existence beyond the current occupant of the White House or of this house or of that house. So I understand why people want to believe that Trump is racist, and when Trump goes, somebody better will come. But this is not about Trump. It's not about George W. Bush. It's about this theme in American history that needs to be uprooted.
Yeah, I think, Vijay Prashad, we can add that Barack Obama said, "I'm good at killing people," and bragged about bombing 8 countries, and they weren't predominantly white Christian countries. Looking at the actions of these governments, you've written recently also about Trump's war making in Syria and Iraq, continuing Obama's and Bush's, and how Turkey's goals are quite different from U.S. goals. What's the latest in your view of what's happening in Syria and Iraq?
Well, you see, it's interesting. There were people during the election who, I think quite correctly, worried that Hillary Clinton's platform was very hawkish. And they falsely assumed that Donald Trump was the inheritor of American isolationism, you know, which is a strand in far-right thinking in the United States. But Trump was never an isolationist. You know, he, like his compatriot Ted Cruz, had promised to bomb ISIS with great ferocity. I mean, Ted Cruz was genocidal in his language. He, in fact, said, threatened to use some kind of either nuclear weapons or chemical weapons, because he said, "We will make the desert glow." You know, this is genocidal language that strand of the Republican Party was using. So, to my mind, David, during the election, I never saw much of a difference between the Clinton hawkishness and, you know, this great brutality from Trump and Cruz and others. You know, I didn't see any evidence of isolationism. I was puzzled when people said, well, on foreign policy, at least Trump is not going to go and overthrow countries. There's no evidence that he wouldn't. And indeed, since coming to office, they've ramped up the bombing in Iraq and in Syria. And there have been, I think, quite grotesque, episodes of massive civilian death. Air Wars, which is a nonprofit group that monitors civilian casualties, showed that in the first week of March, there were 1,000 civilian casualties as a result of U.S. bombing raids. There's a great brutality here. And then, the various very hesitant and slow moves towards the ceasefire, peace deal, etc. As these were coming together, you had the U.S. ambassador to the U.N., her name is Nikki Haley, former governor of South Carolina, absolutely no experience in foreign affairs. But Ambassador Haley then says that, once again, repeats that slogan. She doesn't directly say Assad must go. In other words, Bashar al-Assad, the current president of Syria, must go. But she said that he is a hindrance to peace, which is basically the same thing. You know, so to my mind, the United States is not operating in this region to help facilitate any peace moves. In fact, quite the opposite. It's been churning up the kind of internal contradictions in both, but mainly Syria, but also in Iraq, such that, you know, of course, the Turkish government has now abandoned its pro-Western orientation, and it's gone into, to some extent, the camp of the Russians, of the Iranians, etc. And even there, this internal kind of American paranoia about Russian intervention, etc., has destroyed the possibility of any Russian and American collaboration. And I don't mean collaborate together to divide up Syria. This is not the era of Sykes-Picot where the French and British divided it up. But come to some understanding and try to bring the temperature down in Syria. All that is off the table, you know. So instead, you see the United States bombing ferociously in northern Syria. You see the U.S. making diplomatic statements that suggest that it doesn't want to calm the tensions down in the country. And here, to be perfectly frank, if Hillary Clinton had been president, it would have been almost exactly like this. So I'm afraid the American consensus regarding war-making around the world, disregard for peace in other lands, is continuing business as usual.
Wasn't the silver lining that people thought they perceived in Trump not that he would be less militaristic? He wanted a bigger military, kill their families, steal their oil, and so forth. But that there was one country he seemed like he might be less hostile to, and that was Russia. And that he seems to have come under considerable pressure to become more hostile toward Russia.
Well, here you're correct. Yes, indeed. But again, let's go back. You'll remember that when Hillary Clinton became Secretary of State, she also wanted a reset. There is an understanding, I believe, in the U.S. foreign policy establishment that the temperature or the tensions between the United States and Russia are at too high a point. You know, there was a moment when the Soviet Union collapsed, and Boris Yeltsin essentially became the American man in Moscow. At that time, there was a hope that Russia would become a so-called partner of the West. In other words, as American power became totally global without any real challenger, it was hoped that Russia would become something like Germany, Britain, France, etc., you know, have nominal independence in terms of its foreign policy, but really along the grain of American interests. And so the group of seven countries, which had been created in 1974, now brought Russia on board. It became the group of eight. At this same period, Russia was, of course, at a great low point. The economy had collapsed. The political situation inside the country was in very, very great turmoil. The so-called oligarchs were stealing everything in the country. And the place was a mess. And then you had the emergence of a new generation of leaders coming out of the old apparatus who wanted a stronger Russia. They, I think, felt humiliated by the 1990s. And among them was Vladimir Putin. Putin is not, you know, a singular figure. He represents a generation of people who are now in their 50s and 60s who were humiliated by the 1990s. And these people, wanted to rebuild the military. Their first test case was in Chechnya. And they were deeply suspicious of the attempt by NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, to move its border right up to the Russian border. At the same time, they were quite suspicious of moves by the United States and its allies to encircle China. You know, the strategic apparatus inside Russia was as worried about the move of NATO towards the Russian border as it was about the reestablishment of American bases along the Pacific Rim. You know, the Americans, after the Cold War ended, initially left the Philippines base at Subic Bay and then returned. And this return of the base, a ratcheting up of rhetoric around encircling Eurasia, I think was marked this generation. You know, if one thing marked them, it was the humiliation of the 1990s, and the second was what they saw as an American attempt to keep them on their knees. And so in the American foreign policy establishment, there has been a section that has wanted to bring the temperature down between the United States and Russia, restart some kind of talks over nuclear weapons, restart talks about collaboration in the world order, etc. You know, and there's another section in the foreign policy establishment that seeks to drive a wedge in Eurasia between Russia and China. One section says, go after the Chinese, you know, concentrate your venom on them and make friends with Russia. The other side says, no, befriend the Chinese and use your new friendship with the Chinese against the Russians. By the way, the leader of this second, you know, strand is Henry Kissinger, who's been directly saying, befriend the Chinese, attack the Russians. Initially, this was the Trump position. You split the Chinese and Russians, befriend the Russians, attack the Chinese. But this has fallen apart for reasons that I think have very little to do with the foreign policy establishment itself and have everything to do with the fact that it is probably the case that both the Russians overplayed their hand and the Democrats were very angry about the election result. And now, of course, the so-called reset that the foreign policy establishment wants to see one way or the other is not happening. Meanwhile, the Russians and the Chinese have cemented their economic ties. As Russia finds itself being sanctioned in Europe, it started to sell energy with increasing volumes into China. Russia and China have now militaries that do war games together. They are so integrating their militaries, they're integrating their strategic understanding. So I think these various approaches to isolate Eurasia or to break Eurasia up are not going to work. And so even if Trump had succeeded in making an outreach to Russia, I think the game of making Russia a friend and China the enemy would not have worked.
It seems, though, that Russia in recent, in just the past few years, has cut its military spending from about $70 billion down to about $48 billion a year, while the United States is up above $700 billion and increasing rapidly, with U.S. officials almost openly talking in the media about the motivation of profit for the hostility with Russia. I mean, how much of this is not geostrategic, but simply corruption in Washington, D.C.?
Well, this, David, will take us for several hours.
we have several minutes.
Militarism. But the quick answer is that, yes, you know, the increase that Mr. Trump has requested on the military budget of $54 billion is itself 80% of the total Russian budget for its military. So the scales are uneven. One of the reasons the Russians have been cutting their military budget is because they have faced problems as commodity prices drop. You know, I don't think we should read the decline in military spending as somehow, you know, an indication that the peaceniks have taken power in Moscow. That's not the case. It's that they have economic problems and they're cutting down on their military spending. You may remember that during the Chechnya war and after, the Russians rapidly increased military spending because they said that during the Yeltsin years, those years of great humiliation, the military had been destroyed. So, you know, the rhetoric of Putin actually in those years is similar to the rhetoric of Trump now, saying the military needs to be rebuilt. You know, it has been squandered by my predecessor, etc. So there was a high point in military spending. Then there was the commodity boom collapse, and they had to decline in their military spending. The United States is a very curious country. You know, here it has become structural in the economy for so-called counter-cyclical spending. In other words, spending that governments do when the economy is in a downturn. In most civilized countries, counter-cyclical spending happens in education, healthcare, you know, civilian infrastructure, etc. In the United States, counter-cyclical spending basically happens through military spending. And it's often deficit finance. So it's going to go into the debt, the long-term debt of the country. And that's what Mr. Trump understands that he can do. You know, he promised major civilian infrastructural spending. I don't think he's going to be able to get that money. You know, these people, the so-called Freedom Caucus and these so-called fiscal conservatives, they are conservative on everything except military spending. You know, that's why it's easy to do counter-cyclical spending on the military side of the budget. Because these fraudulent conservatives, for them, they want to conserve on every social program. Moment you say, let's buy a gun, they're like, that's great, let's go do it. There's no fiscal conservatism when it comes to military spending. You know, that Freedom Caucus should have been lined up in front of the White House protesting that $54 billion increase on the military side that Trump had requested. But they're not going to be there. You know, this you can continue to do, and nobody challenges you, neither the Republicans nor the bulk of the Democratic Party. So this is a little game that gets played in Washington, D.C., and I think I would hesitate before overreading the decline in Russian military spending.
Yes, I without attributing motives to Russia, it simply helps with the U.S. argument that Russia is not a threat of global domination when its military is being cut and the U.S. is 10 times the size. But we have just a few minutes left. Vijay Prashad, I think you hit something where you said neither the Republicans nor the Democrats will oppose, because in fact, there isn't even any conversation in the U.S. media about the increase in military spending. You have the Democrats opposing the cuts to everything else, giving people the misunderstanding that that Trump's proposing a smaller budget and cutting things. And so you have the small government people out there in favor of it, when in fact he's moving the same size budget, moving money from everything else to the military. How will we ever stop that if no one will even talk about it?
Well, look, I mean, the idea that the United States needs to spend at least $700 billion a year, that's the public military budget. God knows what the secret budget is. There's money for Joint Special Operations Command. We don't know what is spent. That $700 billion a year of scarce public resources is spent towards this military, which finds itself able to bomb countries, but not actually, take control of them, should send a very serious signal to the public. I mean, we need to talk about the failed war in Afghanistan, where the Taliban is back. We need to talk about the fact that the United States made an immense strategic, for its own personal understanding of the world, immense strategic error by taking out both the Taliban and the government in Iraq, because that, of course, you know, removed from world history Iran's two great adversaries on Iran's two borders. But here you have this massive military power used so poorly, able to bomb from the sky, kill civilians, but not able to actually win the hearts and minds of people. Surely there's a better way to do it than buying more B-52s, more nuclear submarines. Surely there are ways in which to strengthen the diplomatic corps. Surely there's a way to improve relations with people through student exchanges and such like. You know, I mean, one has to be quite aggressive in arguing against the idea that security is won through military force. It seems to me security is won through human interaction and not through military force. In fact, the argument that it's won through military force is entirely erroneous, and history shows us that. Human-to-human interaction that builds real security. And I think the country has forgotten that.
It's a great point to end on. We're out of time. Vijay Prashad, Professor of International Studies at Trinity College, your latest book, The Death of the Nation and the Future of the Arab Revolution. Thank you very, very much for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
My pleasure. Thanks a lot.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.
To Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Countersnap.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, the saber rattling between the U.S. and North Korea seems to amp up daily, with Kim Jong-un shooting off missiles and Donald Trump his mouth, with vague threats to go after the country. Corporate media's cartoonish portrayal of North Korea doesn't help as we try to understand how things got to this pass and how we can get out of it. We'll hear from writer and activist Yun Lee from Zoom In Korea. Also on the show, April is Sexual Harassment Awareness and Prevention Month, with Fox News helpfully providing Exhibit A of why it's needed. April is also when we get to Equal Pay Day, when women's earnings catch up to men's from the year before. These issues are connected, but not often by the press. We'll talk with Jennifer Reich, legal director of Equal Rights Advocates. That's coming up, but first we'll take a quick look back at recent press. That the main economic story of the last 40 years is the massive upward redistribution of income is hard to deny. The top 1% share of national income has more than doubled over this period to over 20%. But as Dean Baker reminds on Fair.org, the rich, who have used their control over the levers of economic power to ensure that an ever larger share of the country's wealth goes into their pockets, don't want people to pay attention to that. So, quote, they endlessly push out nonsense stories to try to divert the public's attention from how they structured the rules to advance their interests. And since the rich own the newspapers, they can make sure that we hear those stories, close quote. That makes for news articles like one the Boston Globe ran recently titled How the Baby Boomers Destroyed Everything. Writer Bruce Cannon Gibney, evidently with a straight face, blames the 77 million people born between 1946 and 1964 for, well, everything. But for one thing, improvidence, as reflected in low levels of savings and high levels of bankruptcy. Well, Baker checked on the link on the bankruptcy stat. The report stated, quote, expensive health care costs from a serious illness before a patient received Medicare and the inability to work during and after a serious illness are the prime contributors to financial crises among those 55 and older, close quote. Doesn't sound like moral failing. We must be missing something. The low savings complaint is bemusing in light of 10 years of complaint from policy types that people weren't spending enough to bring the economy back. Baby boomers, not ExxonMobil or the Koch brothers, are to blame for unaddressed climate change. And they stole from the young thanks to, quote, all those tax breaks, bailouts, easy money, deregulation, and the bubbles they spawned, close quote. And then they tolerated astounding debt expansion in order to keep the goodies flowing. So, yeah, the vast numbers of poor and middle-class people between 53 and 71 are as responsible as, say, Larry Summers for entrenched inequality. Well, articles like this might make you laugh, but the intent isn't funny, which is, as Baker writes, to, quote, tell folks to ignore all those incredibly rich people with vast amounts of money. The reason most people are not seeing rising living standards is the damn baby boomers who expect to get Social Security and Medicare just because they paid for it. Close quote. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group Fair. The Washington Post suggests that people in Seattle and San Francisco should be worried about being hit by a ballistic missile from North Korea, citing an analyst who described such an event a bit cryptically as a looming threat, but not a current threat. If the concern is that the saber rattling between Kim Jong-un and Donald Trump could indeed have dire consequences, it's hard to see how such stories help, or maps that show ranges for North Korea's missiles far greater than any actually tested missiles have gone, or the conflation of nuclear and non-nuclear weaponry. But we're equally ill-served by a failure to interrogate U.S. policy on the Korean Peninsula and corporate media's reduction of North Korea to caricature in the time-honored method reserved for official enemies. As we record this show, Trump is meeting with China's president, Xi Jinping, and we're told North Korea is at the top of the agenda. Trump having declared, if China is not going to solve North Korea, we will. What does that mean, and how has it come to this? We're joined now by writer and activist Yun Lee of Zoom in Korea, a project of the Solidarity Committee for Democracy and Peace in Korea. She's also a fellow at the Korea Policy Institute. Welcome to Counterspin, Yun Lee.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, the Chinese foreign minister just described the U.S. and North Korea as like two accelerating trains coming toward each other with neither side willing to give way. And I think people may well wonder how we got to such a disturbing point. Let's start with the U.S. What historically have been the U.S.'s intentions or goals with regard to North Korea, and have those changed?
So many people in the United States don't realize that the U.S. has maintained the threat of a nuclear attack against North Korea for decades. From 1958 to 1991, the U.S. had hundreds of nuclear weapons in the southern half of the Korean Peninsula in South Korea. So at that time, North Korea's countermeasure to deter a U.S. nuclear attack was to forward deploy all of its conventional forces near the DMZ. In 2001, when George W. Bush came to power, many things changed. There were technological advancements, and he also made doctrinal changes centered around very high-tech, precision-capable weapons that gave the U.S. preemptive strike advantage. He named North Korea part of the Axis of Evil. He also listed North Korea as one of seven countries that were potential targets for a U.S. preemptive strike in the U.S. Nuclear Posture Review. So then, in response to that, North Korea had to develop a new kind of deterrence, and that's when it seriously turned to developing nuclear weapons. And its first nuclear test was in 2006. Since that time, what the United States has tried to do is stall North Korea's nuclear development, tying it up through negotiations that basically went nowhere, at the same time constantly threatening to bring about North Korea's collapse through sanctions that were crippling its economy, and also military exercises that were very provocative. They simulate war plans that now include the decapitation of the North Korean leadership and include nuclear first strike. U.S.-North Korean relations during the previous Obama administration was a contest between Obama's policy of strategic patience, which is basically waiting and preparing for the eventual collapse of the North Korean regime, and then North Korea's policy called Pyongjin, which was making parallel progress in economic development and also developing its nuclear deterrence capability. Towards the end of Obama's presidency, the consensus in Washington was that strategic patience had basically failed. North Korea obviously has not collapsed. On the contrary, many people who have been there recently come back and report that they've made progress in their economic development. And now experts are warning that North Korea will soon have, if it doesn't already have, the capability of launching an ICBM with a miniaturized nuclear warhead that can strike the continental United States. Kim Jong-un's New Year's speech earlier this year contained a message that basically they were ready to test launch an ICBM. So that's basically how we got to this situation. The U.S. and South Korean militaries are now developing and also deploying missile defense capability. The aim of that is basically neutralizing North Korea's nuclear weapons. So now, in response to that, what North Korea is doing is developing countermeasures that can evade the missile defense system. And that's what the recent missile tests have been about. So it's this basic back-and-forth cat-and-mouse game of U.S. developing nuclear first strike capabilities and then North Korea developing deterrence capabilities. And we've become very confused in the United States because the mainstream media likes to exaggerate the North Korea nuclear threat, but we never get news of what the U.S. has been doing over the past decade. And we should be very clear that what this is all about is actually U.S. nuclear first strike advantage against North Korea, and North Korea reacting to that by developing its deterrence capability.
Well, yes, reporting is this world where there's just an unspoken acceptance of the legitimacy of the United States doing things that official enemies are not allowed to do. I mean, the very idea of strategic patience, we're just going to wait until the regime collapses. You know, we can understand why North Koreans might not want to co-sign that as a plan, but it also depends so much about where you start the clock. In the U.S. media, as you've said, it's always North Korea taking the provocative action and the United States responding, and that's getting it backwards, you think?
You know, there is a double standard in U.S. condemnation of North Korean missile tests because the U.S. also continuously tests ballistic missiles. In 2015 alone, the U.S. flight tested the Minuteman III ICBM from California, from the Vandenberg Air Force Base, five times in 2015 alone. So, I mean, every country has a sovereign right to test its weapons capability. That's how you know if it works or not. And that's precisely what North Korea is doing. So we should also note that there is a double standard there.
Well, what concerns do you have specifically about what looks like being the Trump administration's approach? I mean, we've seen both Trump and Nikki Haley say China has to deal with North Korea. And that's supposedly the point or one of the points of this meeting with Xi Jinping. What do you make of that?
Many experts have noted that it is not a good idea for the United States to outsource its North Korea policy to China. First of all, I mean, we should be very clear that the two countries have very different strategic interests in the region. So it is not a good idea from the U.S. point of view to rely on China so much to carry out its policy because it doesn't make sense. China has made very clear to the United States that if it wants cooperation in North Korea, it should first reverse its very controversial decision on the deployment of the THAAD anti-missile system in South Korea that is right now in the process of being deployed. And it is a very controversial issue. Probably it will be on the agenda of the summit this weekend. China considers the THAAD system, if it's based in South Korea, a threat to its security, because the radar that comes with the system can be used for surveillance activity on Chinese missile. And so far, the Trump administration has been very aggressive in pushing that deployment forward. Meanwhile, people in South Korea have been very opposed to it and are protesting every day outside the deployment site. If the U.S. continues to push that forward, it may make it very difficult to get Chinese cooperation on North Korea. Secondly, China does not want the collapse of the North Korean regime because that would create a huge refugee crisis at its border, and that's the last thing that China wants. China also does not want the prospect of a unified Korean peninsula that is led by a pro-U.S. South Korean government right next door as its neighbor. So for all of these reasons, it's probably not a good idea for the U.S. to rely on China to carry out its policy based on its strategic interests. It is more in U.S. interest to negotiate directly with North Korea for North Korea to basically cap its nuclear and missile tests.
Well, that moves me to the final question, because I'd like to talk about other ways forward. You know, we know media kind of get into saber-rattling mode, and it gets very difficult to hear other voices. But and people who seek peace or an end to conflict are almost in a parallel conversation. But what possible ways forward do you see for those who seek an end to the conflict?
The only sensible path at this point is dialogue, sitting down with North Korea, and coming up with a fundamental solution to the crisis. We should note that last year in July, North Korea basically put out a statement that was not picked up or noticed by the Western media, but it laid out the terms for denuclearization, and all of the conditions that it laid out had to do with removing the threats to its sovereignty that's posed by U.S. nuclear weapons. That gives an indication that that's what the North Koreans are fundamentally interested in resolving. So a fundamental solution in my mind would be, first of all, ending the annual provocative war exercises that the United States military does every year in South Korea, abandoning the U.S. nuclear first strike prerogative, and then signing a peace treaty that will bring closure to the unended Korean War, eventually leading to the withdrawal of U.S. troops from the Korean Peninsula. And then in exchange, North Korea should halt its nuclear weapons development, meaning no more tests, no more nuclear tests or no more missile tests, basically capping it, and a commitment to non-proliferation. In my mind, that is the only sensible path to resolve the current situation.
We've been speaking with Yoon Lee of Zoom In Korea, online at zoominkorea.org. Thank you very much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you.
That Donald Trump defended Fox News host Bill O'Reilly in the wake of revelations that the network has paid millions in settlements for sexual harassment lawsuits lodged against him is the least surprising news ever. Though he did give it the Trump touch by saying he didn't believe the women and Bill's a good guy, days after declaring April Sexual Harassment Awareness and Prevention Month. Media could use the O'Reilly story to shed light on workplace harassment. And while they're at it, the range of inequities and indignities that continue to confront women in the workplace. They might start by asking what sexual harassment has to do with another April event, Equal Pay Day. Jennifer Reich is legal director at the group Equal Rights Advocates. She joins us now by phone from San Francisco. Welcome to Counterspin, Jennifer Reich.
Thank you for having me.
Well, this is a nexus of issues, but let's start with pay. Equal Pay Day, when women's earnings catch up to men's of the previous year, is a symbol, you know, to call attention to the gender pay gap. But equal pay is the sort of thing that's hard to oppose. So it seems like what people do is say, like this Forbes columnist I found, that those who complain about inequity, quote, overlook that sex-based pay discrimination is already illegal, unquote. What's the misunderstanding at work there, and what do you see as the value of exercises like Equal Pay Day?
Well, as you pointed out, Janine, Equal Pay Day is, of course, a day that is marked but not celebrated because it always is a reminder of how many days women are still working into this year just to catch up with the earnings of their full-time male counterparts. And I think there's just a widespread misperception and misunderstanding of what the gender pay gap is really about. And, you know, a failure to recognize that it is the result not only of continuing discrimination and the results of implicit and explicit bias against women in the workplace, but also the result of a lot of mechanisms and things going on in the labor market that result in women being underpaid. And they are pernicious, and they are often sort of part of the way we see things as just being the way they are. So occupational gender segregation, for example, is a big contributor to the gender wage gap. And that's not, you know, the result of any specific employer necessarily making a discriminatory decision. It's really about the result of many, many years, and for many different reasons, women, first of all, ending up in jobs that pay less, and on the flip side, the jobs where women work being the lowest paid jobs in our economy. And so we both undervalue the work that women do, and in fact, we can see that when women enter a profession, the more women enter a profession or field, the lower the pay of that field becomes. So there is clearly still a long way we have to go to get to a place where women and men are truly experiencing equal opportunity in employment and where they're being paid equally for doing substantially equal work. The other thing is that just because something is illegal doesn't mean it doesn't happen. That's sort of the most obvious thing as well, is that we see with sexual harassment, which has been considered an unlawful form of sex discrimination since the early 80s and was outlawed really by Title VII, which was passed in 1964, it is still the number one reason why people call equal rights advocates for help on our toll-free helpline, and it is one of the most common reasons why people file discrimination charges is based on sexual harassment-related issues. Just because something has been declared unlawful certainly doesn't mean that it's been eliminated. In fact, we've seen, I think, a real upswing in a lot of these issues coming to the fore over the last few months.
Let's move on to that. In his defense of Fox head Roger Ailes, with his more than 20 allegations of sexual harassment, Donald Trump said that his daughter Ivanka would find another career or find another company if she faced any harassment. And his son Eric Trump said Ivanka wouldn't allow herself to be subjected to harassment. Now, besides ignorant, that's revelatory in the implied assumption that a woman should and can just quit a job where she's harassed. And it points to harassment as an economic concern, but that's rarely how it's presented.
You're absolutely right, Janine, and it is an economic concern. The thing that really appalls me about those comments, too, is that, of course, it places the blame for harassing conduct on the women who are subjected to it and puts the onus of change on individual women as opposed to on the institutions and employers and individuals that are perpetrating the harassment and creating cultures inside those environments where men are given a free pass to harass women and where women are taught that tolerating that harassment is the price of a paycheck. Ivanka Trump is worth almost $1 billion. She doesn't have to stay at any job. That's not the reality for the 99.999% of us who do not have that kind of wealth. And it's really the wrong question or wrong way to approach the entire issue. And women who face sexual harassment are often in a position where they are trying to support themselves and their families. They are living paycheck to paycheck, and they cannot afford to risk losing even an hour of pay, let alone being out of work altogether for any period of time, or they are staring down the barrel of a gun that, you know, could really threaten their ability to provide food and shelter for their family. And so to make the onus and burden of having to somehow respond to that kind of behavior, that unlawful behavior and use of authority, like misuse and abuse of authority like that, on the women who are abused is the worst kind of hypocrisy and victim blaming imaginable. And it really reflects a fundamentally sexist view of women as those who should expect to be acted upon and should have to accommodate the objectification as a condition of being in the workplace at all. And that's just not acceptable, and it's also not in line with what our civil rights laws say.
It is, though, the feeling or the sentiment or belief of the President of the United States. So I just want to ask you, finally, what can you tell us about the direction of things under Donald Trump on this set of issues? Because it certainly, I mean, these comments are the tip of the iceberg, as we understand. But, you know, we know we have folks fighting in the opposite direction. So what are the sort of preeminent concerns that you have about moves that Trump has made or may make?
Well, of course, Trump has rescinded several executive orders that were providing for some additional protections and strengthening existing protections against sexual harassment as well as against wage theft and other common that affect many, many millions of women workers every year, including the executive order that he signed revoking the Fair Pay and Safe Workplaces order just last week. And while those of us who are on the side of workers and who are standing up for, you know, have been prepared and have been standing up for folks for the last, you know, decades, we're still here and we're not going anywhere. We do know that we have a really tough fight ahead because we have a president who really doesn't seem to understand what the laws are or why they're important and has put into positions of power in the Department of Labor, in the Department of Education, individuals who also don't seem to prioritize the enforcement of the rights under the laws that actually, you know, their agencies are responsible for enforcing. On the other hand, however, we still have remedies available. We still have ways for people to come forward. And I think now more than ever, what's really becoming clear is that what we need to do is stay strong and stay united and actually support one another and support women in taking some forms of collective action, and collective meaning just coming together even just as a pair or as a small group, because fighting these things alone is always more difficult than fighting them as one. And so I think that it points to the need for us to stay vigilant on our defense. And even though, for example, President Trump has rescinded the executive order that would have prohibited federal contractors from discriminating against employees on the basis of their sexual orientation, we have, you know, the Seventh Circuit and other circuits now considering decisions that would expand the scope of and declare that, that our existing civil rights law, Title VII, actually does prohibit discrimination based on sexual orientation because it already says that you can't discriminate based on sex. And so the implications of those court decisions could be really, really broad and also could provide, you know, additional protection and at least a line of defense against any changes to federal policy or enforcement priorities that we might see coming down the pike. No doubt about it, we have a really tough road ahead if we want to preserve the rights that we have and also ensure that women are not intimidated into silence when it comes to bringing these issues up. But I think that the courage of people in positions of kind of high visibility and high authority, I think, are really important to encouraging women who are not in those kinds of positions of power and visibility to band together, to speak up, and, you know, to know that that regardless of what the president says, the laws are still there, and we, the advocates who represent women and working people, are still here, and we're going to keep fighting.
We've been speaking with Jennifer Reich, legal director at the group Equal Rights Advocates. Find them online at equalrights.org. Jennifer Reich, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you, Janine.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. For more information, you can check out our website, fair.org. The show's engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Radio Eco Shop.
This is Radio Eco Shop with Alex Smith. Welcome. I've got a great science interview for you in the second half of this program. Dr. David Carlson, the director of the World Climate Research Program, will tell us how unpredictable our future has become. But first, this surprise guest. The term deep state used to be kept carefully out of bounds for the mainstream media. Now, with the machinations of the Trump regime, the leaks, and the Russians, the deep state is part of open talk. But what is it? Robin Upton has been documenting the deep state for a long time. Robin is a mathematician by training. He's a radio podcast host and a researcher's researcher. He was raised in the United Kingdom and Denmark, but since 1998, Robin Upton has picked a new home, Bangladesh. We've connected by a maybe questionable cell phone line, so let's get right to it. Robin, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you. It's great to be on the air. I've been a listener of yours for several years, and I know that Lynn Gary, who started the podcast that I do, Unwelcome Guests, regularly used to host your material, so I'm chuffed to be here.
Yeah, it's great to get together because I think we've got some things in common and some things different. Well, let's get to it. For those who don't know, what is the deep state?
Well, it depends who you're asking. The research that you mentioned in the intro is an encyclopedia that I thought I'd been helping with. I found that while I was researching material for Unwelcome Guests, and I found basically a wiki, which, I mean, you know what a wiki is, it depends on what the who's put the content in. But I thought, because of the what was there, and I thought there's real potential here to actually document what's going on, what at least from what I thought I had to help people understand, and to bring in the deep state. I'm going to define that as a loosely, I mean, it's not a unified command. There's pretty little in terms of paperwork on this. You don't get appointed to it. You don't have positions in it. It's not like the public power structures, but it is something like a power structure. It's a loosely affiliated group of sometimes competing, sometimes cooperating people that I call deep politicians, for want of a better name. But the image is of, and we know what a puppet leader is, and my suggestion is that a lot of the so-called top leaders of the nation states, or maybe even of multinationals, of these, they're the front men, but they're not actually making the decisions. So where do the decisions get made? A range of different places. We got another term that we use on WikiSpooks, deep state milieu. I've got to give credit before I talk any more about the deep state to Peter Dale Scott. He's a former diplomat, professor of English. He's Canadian born, but he did a lot of work to publicize when he coined the term. And it is remarkable how that term has just popped up in corporate media sources. I don't call them mainstream because I consider them to be pretty extremist in their views. I mean, maybe a lot of them, and they have apparently different titles, but we know about media consolidation. So I think that the thesis that behind the scenes, a lot of these nominally independent organizations are actually well-coordinated, I don't think that's going to raise too many eyebrows. So it's a group of people who organize, use these front men, some of them, national leaders, people, talking about Obama, how much power does he have? I don't think you can get to be president without oiling a few palms, so to speak. So the deep state is the label that we use to describe these processes. Now, that may differ from how the deep state is described on CNN or other such sources. I mean, it would be surprising if it didn't, because there's a lot of evidence that deep state actually more or less controls the fourth estate, the media. So the question of why is the deep state suddenly being talked about now is certainly an interesting one. But at the outset, let's be clear that different people use that phrase deep state to mean different things.
Right. Okay. Now, the storyline on sites like Zero Hedge is that Donald Trump is an outsider being thwarted at every turn by an established power structure, beyond conventional party politics. It sounds like you agree with that.
I'm not expecting a lot from the Trump presidency. I mean, I fundamentally at heart, Alex, I am an optimist, but don't misunderstand me. If Trump has an accident and is found dead or disabled somehow, well, then I think that's pretty strong evidence that he was a threat to the establishment. If that doesn't happen, I'm not actually expecting that. There's a lot of ways of exerting influence over people. I mean, I don't know a great deal about Trump's shady past, but I do believe that it's pretty difficult to accumulate that amount of wealth without transgressing and without incurring a few debts, so to speak, to established figures. So I think it's a lot more plausible. I would not be disappointed at all to be proved wrong on this, but I think it is quite plausible that Trump is there because somebody had to be there, and people are generally wising up to the charade of democracy. So having had somebody who possibly dark-skinned Americans thought was going to be a breath of fresh air, and, you know, it promised things like, let's shut down Guantanamo, so Obama was nominally a change, remember that change that we could believe in that got talked about a lot before the election and didn't actually materialize. I think Trump might be a replay, but appealing this time for people who are disillusioned with the standard party politics. So he have to capitalize on that, present himself as a kind of maverick figure and say, well, yeah, I'm going to really change things this time. So it'd be great if a lot of positive change does materialize. But looking at the team of people that he's assembled, doesn't give me great hope for the future.
Well, before we go deeper, Robin, I have to ask, why did you choose Bangladesh as your home?
The answer to this question keeps changing, but maybe it chose me. I grew up in Northern Europe, and one seminal experience for me as a kid, I saw Live Aid, and I saw huge numbers of desperately hungry Africans, and I was really shocked because, you know, there they were on the living room TV, and I'd never seen anything like it, and I was just appalled. And that was the first time it happened, and, you know, the message is, okay, we got to give these guys some food, so that means money, so you got to pay some money, and then the problem will go away. And yeah, appalled at their plight, and inspired by people one or two people, you know, the tabloid media sold the house and gave all the money to Oxfam. But then I was more deeply appalled when the same thing more or less happened. It kept happening. You know, it kept being these famines, and I thought, well, if humanity can put a man on the moon, how hard is it going to be to move food where we've obviously got plenty of it from one country to another country where we haven't got plenty of it? Well, that pointed out to me that actually feeding the hungry, well, people will rattle tins, but it didn't appear to be a high priority. And then I thought that's really appalling. And I don't want to grow up to be somebody who says, oh, isn't it terrible? I'll give them £10 and what's for lunch? Who's going to win the game, do you think? You know, I just thought that's so much more important than a lot of the sort of cultural sideshows that people tend to spend a lot of time on, that I wanted to actually do something about it. So I had that awareness that living in the so-called developed countries, I was not experiencing reality in the way that the majority of people in the world do. So lacking that knowledge, it's an act of great faith to say, well, I'm going to give some money to some people that I've never really checked out, and I'm going to pray that somehow makes a difference. So if that's not enough, I mean, we know about corruption, that's a given. So I'm going to go and see what's actually happening. And I thought, well, you know, I got a privilege here. I got a university education. I get a grant. I get some training. And then I'm going to go myself. And that money isn't going to go missing if it's me there face to face. So that inspired me to try and find a way out of. A metaphor I've used is the Truman Show, where he's living this life, and is somehow alerted that actually there's another world outside. So that was really what inspired me to try it. And then it was just a personal connection came up. I was like, oh, well, we need somebody to teach computers in an orphanage in Bangladesh. I said, well, I know a bit about computers. They probably don't know much in Bangladesh. They've probably never seen the things before. So that got me started. And Bangladesh has a terrible image abroad. You know, when I say I've come back from Bangladesh, the first thing that people do is say, yeah, how's India? And I go, I'll explain, no, this is Bangladesh, that's a little bit different. And then the next response tends to be, are you getting enough to eat? How's your house? Did you get flooded? So that's a side effect of the way that Bangladesh is portrayed by organizations which capitalize on the plight of a few people. But I mean, the truth about Bangladesh is that we've got more than 1,000 people per square kilometer living here, for the most part, quite successfully, quite happily. And, you know, it's a different world in that sense. People have a very different attitude to sort of personal space. From a Western perspective, it's incredibly crowded. But I realized I wanted the contrast. I mean, I wasn't particularly enamored of a lot of the goals of, you know, Western materialism. And I found something here, kind of a wholesomeness. The fact that most people, even now, most people actually eat by growing food themselves, living off the land, and more or less, even when people are living in the city, people have got a village home. So that process, which rounded up people and put them in cities in England centuries ago, the enclosed, that's still really ongoing. People are very connected to the land, very connected to other people. I didn't quite know what I was, you know, the glitch in the matrix. I didn't quite know what I was missing until I came here and I started to see it. I didn't say, well, I'm moving to Bangladesh. I just thought, you know, I'll follow where the wind takes me. And without really intending to, I found myself getting quite at home here.
I think I know what you're talking about. I was in India quite a while ago, but for a few months. And one of the shocking things that I saw there was how happy the average person seemed to be compared to a Canadian. The stress levels were much lower. People smiled. They laughed openly on the streets. So we do have a distorted picture of what's happening overseas, I think.
It goes both ways. I sat in a cafe, and I was surrounded by idyllic pictures of sort of foreign icons. You know, there was Tower Bridge over here, and somewhere else there was like this beautiful pine forest. But it was very clearly not Bangladesh. I'm speaking about Dhaka more than the people in the village. But a lot of people seem to think that outside of Bangladesh, which is actually, it is really difficult for a Bangladeshi to get a visa to get out of Bangladesh. So that's a factor of how the politics and the economics work. But it's also true that the economic system means that the few people who get out, if they put in a few years of hard work, when they move the money back to Bangladesh, then they're fabulous. So it's quite easy to understand, I think, why a lot of people in Dhaka are thinking, yeah, Bidesh, that's abroad, that's an upgrade from living in Dhaka. And I have to point out to people that it's not like you see on the television. I mean, yes, the physical world, that's the easiest part to understand. That people here have, they're generally pretty relaxed, and the support that you get from the people that you grew up with, because everybody shares your home village. You don't move your home village. When people ask me, you know, where's my home village, I got to explain, well, I was born in some random hospital somewhere in a city where my parents happened to be working at the time, and then I moved, and then I moved. And, I have to explain that they basically haven't really got a home village in their sense. And that gives people a new perspective. I can understand how difficult it is for Westerners, to sort of people who've never experienced that, to grasp the support that you get, the feeling of security. if you're alone and cut adrift in the city, well, then money is the lifeline, that nothing is going to happen without money. That's a fact of life for people in the so-called developed world, which for a lot of people here, it doesn't work that way.
You are listening to Radio EcoShock. My guest is alternative radio host and deep state researcher Robin Upton. Right about now, Robin, the media is trying to sell us on the idea that Russia is already at war with the United States, just a covert war by other means. You have said, I believe, in the past that the whole world is engaged in a kind of civil war. What do you mean?
Well, yesterday I was musing on our society, how hard it is to really show compassion. You know, if you've got a job in an institution, the chances are you've got a job description, you've got job guidelines. I mean, in the extreme case, say you're processing forms that people have filled in. A lot of these jobs are done by computer, and that's interesting in itself, that Western society has a lot of functionaries whose jobs could be given over to computer. It doesn't say much for our human capabilities that are exercised in that power system. So I said the whole world is a war in the sense of people are fighting about money. How long? I mean, this one is quite in Dhaka City. We don't have a lot of price tags on things in shops. And if you get on a bus, you don't buy a ticket. That gets negotiated. And yeah, there's going rates for things, but you've got to know them. But the upshot is that there's a lot of time is spent arguing about prices. And what is a price? I mean, it's a notional thing. And I got this sort of semi-outsider's view, because if you live off the land and you grow your own food, well, then you've got to be very attentive to the difference between a healthy plant and a dying plant, and food that's rotten and food that's good to eat. But you don't have a notion of prices. And this is what I mean about the ongoing civil war. Why would so many people in Africa be hungry? Is it because English people don't care about other people? Well, I don't accept that. I think that people on one level do care. And if their activities, if their day-to-day operations and the decisions that they make don't reflect that by, say, getting to the bottom of the problem, let's plant some healthy food crops here, let's try and mitigate the effects of climate change, let's actually get onto this and try and do the best that we can for these people, which would be, I think, a healthy human approach. I'm not talking, I mean, there may be about 1% of humanity psychopaths who don't have a conscience, and for them, well, the world is maybe composed of competing individuals who are all trying to get the most for themselves and never mind anybody else. But the vast majority of humanity isn't like that. Maybe 99% of people actually have a conscience, and they know what it is to suffer, and they look and they can see in somebody's face, well, I don't want to treat somebody badly. So how does this end up in famines? How does it end up in wars? There's this story which is spun about the importance of the economy. We've got to keep the economy growing. What's the economy? The economy isn't going to feed us. We've got to cut down the rainforest to feed the economy. It makes some kind of sense. It's internally distant, this idea about money and economy, but it doesn't seem to me to respect the real world. I mean, you know, we know that we need species diversity. We know that we don't want to replace the whole jungle with a tract of oil palms, and yet it happens and makes money. Or people, this phrase, making money. I mean, it's not making something in the sense of creating it. Well, okay, there's central banks who create money out of thin air. That should help us to see that it's ultimately just a fiction. And then there's businessmen who make money by taking it off somebody else. You know, we're not talking about forges here. That would be one thing that we could talk about. This is a real making of money. You start with no money, and then there's money. Well, that's not what we call making money. It's a long process. There's a lot of ideas connected here, and they're fairly fundamental, I think, to sort of modern Western capitalism. I think it was Derek Jensen who says it's the unspoken assumptions of a society that really define it. You know, we're discussing something, should we do this or should we do that? Well, that's not on a deeper level, because the alternatives, if we say, well, we've got a lot of options here, but of course, everybody has to make money to survive, well, then we've already framed it in a way that is ultimately, it's not changing the hegemony of these central banks. I mean, that's just one set of institutions. You know, it's a whole kind of military-industrial complex. You can boost the economy by making bombs or laser-guided whatever, only boosting the economy, and you can't take jobs away from people. But isn't it terrible how these terrorists kill people? I think, I mean, I've been living here for years, and I go back to the UK every so often, and I do keep in touch with the things with independent media. That helps me to try and hold both perspectives in my mind. But I haven't heard a lot of people questioning the fundamentals. This seems to be the defining institution of our time, more than even, maybe more even than the religion. And to look at the longevity of this idea, that there is a thing called money, and we have to somehow fit our lives and our plans around money rather than the reverse.
You've thought this through, Robin Upton, to the point of constructing a possible alternative economic system. What is friend-to-friend, for example?
I mean, we know what P2P is. That's associated with file sharing. I did, in about 2003, work on a new economic system. This goes back to my dissatisfaction with the modern economic system. That was called economic science when it was brought in. But, I mean, I think that's a very deceitful name, so I'm glad it's just become economics. Because the modern science, as I understand it, is an attempt to understand the world. So we're going to explore what is out there and try and model it and map it and predict it. But economic science seems to me to not be doing that. I lost interest in economics, the normal economics, in my first lecture at university. When the lecturer, you know, given his credit, was going through the introduction and said, are we happy to assume that there's only two goods available in the world? Because we know there's a lot of goods, but we want to graph these, and we're going to use a paper, so let's give it an X and a Y axis. And because if we can model two, we could assume that the same kind of principles are going to hold for lots of goods. Well, I thought, yeah, fair enough, that's quite neat. I like it, X and Y. Next assumption, we're going to assume that everybody is a selfish maximizer, so they just want the most for themselves, and they're not bothered about what happens to other people. Are we happy to assume that? This was a rhetorical question that you asked the first years in economics, and so I don't think he was expecting me to raise my hand and say, well, I know that that's not true, because there are people in this world that I really care about, and I don't want more for myself if that's going to mean that my friends don't have enough or if they get less. So this, he was temporarily nonplussed. And, you know, the best he could come up with is, well, we have to assume this, otherwise we can't do economics. So since economics was a compulsory part of my course and I wanted to pass my course, then I did knuckle down and I passed that economics course. But that was where my real interest finished. Because, I mean, you know how logic works. If A implies B, but A is not true, well, that doesn't tell us anything. If you start with an incorrect assumption, nothing that you build on top of that is going to be of particular merit. So I reinterpreted economics slowly as not a system to explore and explain the real world, but a kind of post hoc justification for why things are the way they are. And if people happen to misunderstand it, an explanation of the real world, well, more fool them. But as we conceived economic literacy, that's another terrible, I would put that phrase in quotes, literacy, teaching people to read, that's opening a world to them where they can go and explore and do what they like. But economic literacy is about telling people this is how the world is and everybody is selfish, and if you don't believe that, well, you're not economically literate, so you can't get promoted to the next stage on your business qualifications. So this is a huge introduction to your question about an alternative economic system. But that was my experience of ordinary economics. And then left to my own devices, I thought, there's a lot of what happens in society is sort of built upon this premise of competing individuals, which we know from our own personal lives, that's not how people actually are. So what would happen if we didn't have that assumption? Could we do anything like sort of economics? Could we build a model which doesn't take that as a given? And at the time, I was looking after my granny who had Alzheimer's, so I would occasionally get a phone call. I can detect its phone spam. It was a scammer. And then I thought, you know, why not betray my grandmother? She's got Alzheimer's. There's no way she doesn't have a memory. So I could get rich at my granny's expense. And I was like, well, I'm not going to do that. She's my granny. But if I can earn $200 in a way that only costs her $100, well, then I'll do it. I can make it good. So instead of becoming a selfish maximizer, I was a maximizer for myself and somebody else. Now that, if we have to be maximizers of any kind, and I think, you know, certainly in terms of calorie intake, that humans are satisficers rather than maximizers. We like to get enough. If we don't have enough, we're really in trouble. But do we necessarily want, do we have unlimited demands? I don't think we do. I think that's part of the sort of modern economics canon. But that was where it started. I thought, could we make a system which doesn't assume that everybody's selfish? And so that was what I called altruistic economics, and people thought it was interesting. I spoke to various people about it. It got a little bit of reportage at the time. Ultimately, I'm not sure that it was a good name for it, because there seemed to be two groups of people. There was people who hadn't much of an economics background, and they would look at it, altruistic economics. That was a turnoff already, because they thought, well, I don't know about economics. And then there was people who had been trained in economics, and they took one look at it and said, well, this is nonsense. Look, that doesn't make sense. So for one thing, it didn't have a concept of money. That's quite a difficult thing for the trained economist to get his head around. I just sort of proposed a model as if I proposed a model of human biology which doesn't have blood. And that blood is often, we talk about, well, we got to keep the money pumping around the economy. That shows this seems to me to be the cart before the horse. Could be another approach to how we organize our activity. Make sure everybody's well-fed and well-housed. And, like, actually, those are the basic requirements more for human than columns balancing in ledgers and spreadsheets, which is the ultimate this fiction. I'll make a long-term prediction that it's a difficult thing to explain, so I won't go into too much detail there. But the fundamental is that most people actually really like being kind, being thoughtful. We have this miracle called the conscience, and most people are quite familiar with it, and that's exactly why they need a lot of training. They have to be told that that's not a consideration, at least from 9 to 5, because huge international orthodoxy that says this is how life has to be. I'm optimistic because I think that alternative opinions are flowing pretty thick and fast compared to when there was no internet. I think people are really questioning what's going on in society. I mean, we haven't talked about some of the things that the deep state gets up to. They'll be familiar to a lot of unwelcome guest listeners.
But I think we are approaching the end of our time together, and I want for our listeners to be able to find out how to browse the back catalog of unwelcome guests. There's some tremendous material in there. How do they find it?
Okay, well, the website is unwelcomeguests.net. That's the plural. And there's a sidebar on the left. So if you want to do a keyword search on the title, so the episode index, you can also use the search box. But it's also organized by category. So if you click on a thing called Category Gallery, then you'll see there's about 750 episodes. Each one has an image and the categories too. You can go in a category. We've got a category on deep politics. So there's a couple of dozen shows, I think, explaining that. There's subcategories as well. That's where you can get down Unwelcome Guests material.
Well, that, I think, is the education we need for the coming world. And from Bangladesh, we've been talking to broadcaster, math whiz, and social voice Robin Upton. And I'm going to put some helpful links in my show blog at ecoshock.org for you to follow up. And by all means, travel to Robin's own website at robinupton.com. Thank you so much, Robin. It's been a pleasure talking with you. I hope we can talk again.
Thank you, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. Anyone can see signs of climate change. Ice is retreating. Each year is the new hottest record. The weather seems unstable. Plus, we have a constant stream of new science from all over the world confirming it. If the situation is becoming clearer, why are some scientists and top scientists still cautious? We'll find out with our next guest, a veteran organizer of scientific research. In 2007, Dr. David Carlson helped put together the International Polar Year. He has directed explorations into the ways oceans and the atmosphere interact. David led the Atmospheric Technology Branch of the U.S. National Center for Atmospheric Research, or NCAR, in the United States. Now Carlson is the director of the World Climate Research Program, or WCRP. From Geneva, David Carlson, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, Alex. Delighted to be with you.
You know, there's a rush now to break climate predictions down into regional models and even to quantify the role of climate change in particular events like superfires or storms. You have a different direction and maybe a worry about all this?
I understand that regional focus, and there's also a lot of very good, very challenging science around the attribution issue that you mentioned. How much does an individual event represent natural variability, or how much does it have a climate footprint or a climate push on it? But I think a larger group of scientists, and especially in the World Climate Research Program, try to look at the larger patterns behind that, what forced that particular event or what set up that region for flood or drought. And in doing that, we rely on past experience quite a lot because we can't run multiple planet experiments at one time. And I think there's a sense that those larger patterns are changing. And the question then is, why are they changing? And what does that do to our predictive skill?
Well, I want to get into that deeper for sure as we get going here. I want to bring up one issue first, though. One of Canada's brightest climate scientists is Dr. Andrew Weaver from the University of Victoria, except he quit to become the first Green Member of Parliament here in British Columbia. Now, on Radio EcoShock, Andrew Weaver questioned whether we need any more climate science. He says, we know more than enough to know that we're in deep trouble. It's time for action. David, what do you think? Do we need a lot more climate science?
That's a very interesting question. I think both answers are correct. We do know absolutely enough to change our energy systems, to change our carbon emissions, etc. But then the interesting question, and you can take this from a national point of view, is how much do we need to change? How can we expect those changes to influence our coastline or our agricultural systems? How long do we have to make those changes? What options? How severe? So, yes, we know absolutely enough to get started, but I think we don't actually know enough to figure out our destination. So it's sort of like a trip. Yeah, let's get in, let's get going. Absolutely. I'm completely on that voyage. But where are we going to go? How are we going to get there? What's it going to look like when we get there? I think those are the questions of climate science.
Well, right. In an email, you told me that patterns are not what was expected. What did you mean?
Yeah, we watch the planet, and one of the things that we try to tease out are the various oscillations. Sometimes it's warm, sometimes it's cold, sometimes it's high pressure, sometimes it's low pressure. And some of these have predictability or patterns that we can detect. And one of these has been the ENSO, El Niño Southern Oscillation System, where warm water, winds, storminess move back and forth across the Pacific. And I think we had gotten, I would say, reasonable skill at predicting some of these. And that gives us confidence that we understand the system. If we say, okay, this year will be a warm event or a cold event in the ENSO warm-cold cycle, and therefore we'll get around the tropics, we'll get more rain here, or we'll get drought here. You know, that gives us a little bit of confidence. And that's important in our interactions with, as we said a moment ago, with regions, because then we can give them some predictions with confidence for agriculture, et cetera. But those patterns have sort of fallen apart. And if we look at ENSO, if you look in the textbooks, it's described as an every 5 to 7 year sort of warm event and then oscillation with a cold event in between, something like that. And 82, 83, 87, 88, 92, 93, 98. It was sort of regular. And then we had this gap from 98 until 2014. So we went, 15, 17 years without a big warm event. So the first thing we say is, well, why did that happen? Then if you watch what we did, we had a rather strong prediction of 2014 as a warm event. NOAA had it. The Bureau of Meteorology had it. It looked like really a good forecast, and then that warm event never showed up. After that, we went back again, and 2015 was actually a valid forecast in that case. We got a pretty good warm event, but its impact, for example, on the North American West Coast, the Eastern Pacific regions, like breaking the California drought or impacts on Peru, Chile, didn't happen the way we thought that. If you watch the predictions that people were saying, finally we'll break the California drought. But 2015 didn't do that. Now we're in 2016, or we just finished 2016, where we had sort of the cold event. And you would say that's not normally a wet year along the U.S. West Coast. But, of course, California just got dumped with a very healing snow, winter snow accumulation. If you watch what's going on in Peru at the moment, it looks like a classic warm event. So these patterns that had some predictability, they were never perfect. And, you know, one warm event was never a perfect mirror of the previous one. But these patterns, which had some predictability, have sort of broken down, at least recently. And there's this new player on the block, which we call the Arctic. And science is quite divided right now about how much is the tropics impacting global and how much is the Arctic impacting global. And it's sort of like tropics, equatorial and tropics pushing on the mid-latitudes and Arctic polar pushing on the mid-latitudes from the polar end. And then the mid-latitudes where most of us live and where these weather patterns evolve seems to be influenced from both directions. And that requires us to sort of rethink our models and rethink our basic understanding.
Yeah, that's for sure. You know, when I was first gathering climate news and reports in the 1990s, the rule was simple. The tropics determine the weather in the mid-latitudes where many of my listeners live. And now we've had Dr. Jennifer Francis of Rutgers as our guest twice, and her observation is that the meltback of Arctic sea ice and lower snow cover on land has coincided, at least, with a jet stream that is slower and is bent, and that can shape significant weather events. What's your assessment on that discussion?
Yeah, she stimulated that, absolutely. And the initial reaction was, no, not possible, you know, can't happen. But there's a dozen studies, mostly from the observational record. If you look carefully, you can see exactly these patterns. Maybe they're in some regions, in some seasons, Northern Hemisphere winter, for example. But you can start to tease out these correlations from the observational records. The tricky bit at the moment, and science is trying to address this, is that the climate models, I was going to say for the most part, I would say many climate models don't reproduce that. Some climate models do. And if you force them in a certain way, sometimes you can get these patterns. So it's an interesting question for us as a climate research community. If one of our tools is telling us one thing, giving us this signal of an Arctic pushback on mid-latitude circulation, and we're not able to confirm that or reproduce that in our models, then I think it's inherent in us, and that's exactly the way the science is going, is to say, okay, what's going on here? And one of the approaches is to say, well, instead of doing this sort of as a sideline, meaning we take a model that's developed for global and we look to see if we see an Arctic, what if we focus the models on exactly this question and compared what Canadian model shows or what NCAR model shows or what the UK model shows and start to make a focus on it? And I think that's exactly the stage that we're at, because we've got this inconsistency where you can see it in the observations if you're careful, and Jennifer and her group really set that off. But it's not possible in many of the models right now to actually pull the physics together and reproduce it. So we're sort of, one of our tools shows a good signal, the observations, but the model's not yet. And I think that's exactly the situation we're in at the moment.
Well, all right, I'll throw a little gas on the model fire when I say that a recent guest has published a paper saying these biophysical climate models fail to include enough influence from humans and from this civilization. And that's Safa Modashari from the University of Maryland. He told us things like population and consumption can really change the environment that we're trying to model, but the biggest climate models have no dynamic inputs for those sorts of things or for the economy. Dave, is that fair? And can we include human drivers now in the Anthropocene?
Well, we have to distinguish between the physical climate models and then the impact and assessment models. We have a sort of a rule of thumb in climate modeling that we call no miracles, meaning we can't imagine some future carbon sink or a carbon removal process that will magically take carbon out. So we have to live with that. The climate models are in the stage where they evolve from purely a physical model to what we call an Earth system model, which would fit what you called, Alex, a biogeochemical model, meaning that carbon actually, you know, plants actually grow, carbon actually goes into the ocean. You actually get an interactive carbon cycle rather than prescribing the carbon cycle. Do they have perfect resolution over urban areas or over tropical forests or any? They don't, because we can add all these features of the models, but we can't at the same time also get them to run 10 kilometer globally. So, we're limited by what our tools are. But my pushback on that comment is that the models are, on the physics, they're actually quite good. And when you are confronted with a challenge like this Arctic feedback, this Arctic influence problem, probably there's a lot to be learned by looking at those models. Why do some models and some under some forcings reproduce this effect? Why do others not? Is the weakness in how they treat the Arctic? Is the weakness in how they move heat and energy from the tropics towards the poles? So we can use the disparity among models as a sort of a diagnostic. And out of that, we'll both understand the system better, but also get better models.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm here with Dr. David Carlson, the director of the World Climate Research Program. I'm a bit nervous that the public is trying to nail down a fixed image of climate change these days. For example, we have several record hot years in a row, likely with Pacific Ocean temperatures as a driver. But what happens if we have three really cold years? Is that still possible?
It's absolutely possible. I don't think we can continue to set records every year. But the forcing function will be carbon. And so if we continue to put CO2 in, and we put a lot of CO2 in both 2015 and 2016, then we're going to get warm years. Is it always going to be a record warm month? We just did record warm February, NASA announced. No, it's not always going to be a record warm. We will not get, I think it would be unlikely for us to see a deep cooling. We're certainly not going to go for record cooling, but we're not going to set a record warm year or a record warm month every month and every year. But that's a little bit misleading, because generally what we're looking at when we look at those records are something easy, relatively easy to measure, like surface air temperature, global surface air temperature. And what we really need to be looking at is where the energy is going, and that's in the interior ocean. And there, to the best ability of our observations, the heating in the interior ocean has been pretty much relentless. So we might get a cool year, or we might get a relatively cool year in the Northern Hemisphere, or we might get a relatively cool year over Europe, et cetera. But that's sort of like the small hair on the long tail of a big dog, and the big dog is the ocean, and that's where we really need to be looking.
Right. A week ago, friends in the East complained to me they were out in shirt sleeves in the afternoon and then snowed into a deep freeze later the same day. You might have been there then. I don't know. But it's not new in March. But, you know, after we get summer weather in December in North America and then hail in July, the public has begun to distrust the weather. Are we becoming too paranoid too soon, or is it the beginnings of climate change?
Yeah, I think that's exactly the right question. If you look at our seasonal prediction for North America, we forecast this warm west, cold east pattern that we had in a recent year, for example. And that didn't really happen this year. And now we have to go back and figure out why. But that does not preclude cold, snowy events. I was just in Montreal, and they got a lot of snow. That does not preclude single cold, snowy events. And I don't think we can take any individual event and assign it as a harbinger of warmer or a harbinger of colder. We have to look at these big patterns. But exactly as you say, Alex, nothing's going to prevent us from getting a deep snow in Montreal or the U.S. Atlantic coast in springtime. And that's, if you look at the weather records, that's when that many of the big snows have happened in the past.
And you wrote to me, ecosystems prior to collapse very often show clear signs of unpredictability. What does that look like? Do you have an example handy?
Yeah, there's several examples. And this is interesting, this question of how does a system become predictable or become less predictable. It's definitely an issue in weather forecasting, and it's a sort of a complex system question. But some of the interesting examples have to do with ecosystems where you have a grazer, it's in balance with its food resource, maybe it's in balance with predators, maybe it's got diseases or parasites, so the system sort of, you get population oscillations, you get good years and then a couple low years and a good year. But when those ecosystems are relatively well in balance, the ecosystem itself functions in this sort of regular pattern, and they become reasonably predictable. If you know how much food resource there has been in a given ecosystem this year, you can predict what the grazers are going to do, and you can probably predict what the predators are going to do. And there's quite a lot of literature on this, especially on terrestrial ecosystems. But one of the things that happens, and unfortunately they have in that science several quite good examples, is when that ecosystem is stressed by changes in the resource base, for example, or changes in the predation pressure, they tend to go into large oscillations. So you get a very large population followed by a very low population collapse, and it might go through that a couple of cycles, and then they get collapsed. It's, how would you say, it's reliable enough, or it's diagnostic enough, so they can watch these amplitudes of these population oscillations and say, whoa, that one's looking sort of wild. We might be close to collapse or something like that. And that's a lot of what in the biodiversity community you see as them building their predictive skill around this change from a regular predictable oscillation to a much wilder, unpredictable, and that lack of predictability then becomes an indicator of imminent collapse of that ecosystem. So it's not a perfect analogy, but it gets us on this issue of what features of a system, complex system, allow it to have predictability, higher predictability at one time and lower predictability at another. And what does that tell us about the external stresses on the system?
What is the World Climate Research Program, or the WCRP, that you direct?
It's mostly a small coordination program for the big world of climate science. Many of our most important activities have to do with the comparison of the climate models. So we do the set the standards, we share the forcing data, we set up the infrastructure so that if you're at Beijing Center or if you're at a Canadian Climate Center or GFDL or UK, then you can share your climate data with other research around the world. And that sharing, that so-called CMIP, Coupled Model Intercomparison Project, then becomes the basis for the IPCC assessments and the UNFCCC policy negotiations. So we don't actually run any of the climate models. We don't actually fund any of those, but we sort of set up the sharing infrastructure, if you will, so that the people running those models can actually share their data and do the intercomparison. And we do a similar thing on the observation side. We share the data on carbon, we share the data on precipitation, et cetera. So we're sort of a coordination body that adds international cooperation and international value on top of these many very strong climate research programs.
Well, that sounds important to me. We do have to be able to talk to one another. And, you know, when I picture how climate research is working, I do see a lot of computing power, and I also see some very experienced scientific researchers that are kind of working together. I wonder if we're going to come to the point, though, where artificial intelligence will be churning away on masses of data much greater than you or I could ever handle, and come up with something and say, hey, by the way, humans, when the nitrogen cycle changes, so does the rainfall, or something that we hadn't expected.
Definitely in the size of data sets, both satellite data sets, ground-based in-situ data sets, ocean data sets, and the climate model outputs, we will use these data mining techniques. I don't think, at least in the short term, that it's going to be a sort of a random search around and artificial intelligence comes up with something, because these are careful, complicated human products. And it's not like something, you know, you can send a data mining a little robot or whatever they're called out to sort of graze around and find something. The climate modelers have been very careful about how these things are constructed. So I don't think there's a big surprise in there. I do think that because we're producing so much of these data, especially from satellites and from climate model outputs, that using these automated tools to visualize some of these things, and I'm not saying there wouldn't be discoveries or even surprises, but I don't think we're going to get a fundamental reset of our understanding of the climate system just because we put so much work into trying to get these models to work in the first place, that I doubt that we're going to, you know, that machines are going to give us any kind of radical change in the way we understand climate.
All right. Now, who determines what the priority global research questions are?
Well, the researchers do this because they have to write their proposals. They have to get them funded. They have to compete for computing resources. And good, that it should actually be that kind of bottom-up energy ideas, explore the difficult, challenging problems. But every one of them, in climate at least, realizes that they can't do it alone individually, and they probably can't do it alone in their institution, so that the Canadian climate modelers need to understand what the Australians are seeing and how their model output compares with what the UK does, etc. So, yes, the energy and ideas grow bottom up, but in order to have a collective voice, in order to also do the kind of comparisons that allows us to both improve at the national level but also improve at the international level, then we need these coordinated activities.
Should we be optimistic about what we can still learn from continuing climate research? David Carlson, what do we hope the payoff could be?
Well, right now I think there's probably three questions. Let's assume that we get a good buy-in to a Paris Agreement. Let's assume that we start to get control over the carbon emissions. I think there's three questions. One is, where is the carbon going to go, which is not a question about how much are we going to emit or how much goes in the atmosphere, but it's really a question of, how strong is the sink in the ocean and how strong is the sink on land? The second question is, how is the weather going to change with the climate, which touches exactly on several of the issues that we've talked about, Alex, which is, how do these extreme events in frequency or duration or timing change as the climate changes? And the third one is a little bit broader question, but I think it's challenging, which is, how will climate change the habitability of the planet and its region? So it gets back to this regional question. And there we're thinking about things like sea level. That's a habitability question for all the coasts around the world. Again, back to these extremes, you know, long-term drought, long-term flood, long-term precipitation changes, large-scale changes in the circulation in the jet stream that we've talked about in this show. So it's a little more elaborate than just how will the climate change, but how will the climate change the habitability of our planet? And I think those three questions, where does the carbon go, how does the weather change with climate, and how does climate change the habitability? I think those are exactly the right questions that we need to know. Whether countries are meeting their carbon targets or not, that's the kind of information that we need.
Well, as we wrap up here, is there anything else that you would like to talk about or tell our listeners?
I think this whole enterprise of climate modeling is one of the remarkable human activities. A climate model is a couple million lines of code. It's trying to represent in physics, in biogeochemistry, in a consistent numerical form, how the system works. How do leaves respond to sunlight? How does cloud processes produce precipitation? How does freshwater run off into the ocean? How does ocean mixing happen in the straits and over the topography of the bottom? It's a really audacious enterprise to say, I think we could actually put all that in a model. And I think that the fact that humans are trying to do it, that, you know, roughly 20 modeling centers around the world are putting a lot of people on this problem, I think that's a really quite a remarkable resource, that their work tends to be disparaged from outside. It's easy to disparage it from outside, but the creativity and the innovation that's going into this task is one of the planet's human resources, and I think we're well set. I mean, that's exactly what humans should be doing. It's not automatic, you know, that it would succeed. So I think that's one of the really audacious task that climate research has put itself, and I really like the fact that the researchers have tried to do that.
These are the tools that Aristotle would have loved to have had.
It would be fun to try and explain to Aristotle and his concept of the phases, how that gets mapped out at 25 kilometer resolution in 47 layers in the atmosphere around the world. That would be a very interesting conversation.
It would be. We've been talking with Dr. David Carlson, the director of the World Climate Research Program in Geneva. You can find out more information with some links in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. David, thank you so much for sharing your time with us.
Alex, it was fun. I'm glad to support what you're doing.
We're out of time again. Thank you for listening. Please join me again next week for more Radio EcoShock.
The economy comes first.
Workers have families to support.
If we don't sell it, someone else will. If we don't sell it, someone else will. If we don't sell it, someone else will. If we
don't sell it, that's all carbon crackhead talk.
Be realistic.
The transition will take years.
But they don't seem to be putting any real effort or money into the one really great emergency and threat that is coming. We have a cooked world. We are on our way towards a biologically dead planet.
In the blink of a lifetime, the whirlwind will sweep it all away.
Then our flight from reality and from the ideals of our founders will get this globe of ours torn to hot, flinders, spinning gases. To us citizens of Green Prairie, this promise of inferno poses a simple question. What new folly can you dream up with your coffee, your grapefruit, your first cigarette to keep yourself a while longer from facing the truth?
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Electronic Intifada's weekly Palestine podcast.
Somehow Karim in Junction 48 is the sequel of what happened in the Nakba in a way.
Once you live in, you know, under oppression, everything you do is art. Even to do art is a resistance to the politics.
The Electronic Intifada.
The Electronic Intifada.
The Electronic Intifada.
This is the Electronic Intifada podcast. In Oakland, I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. You're listening to the Electronic Intifada podcast. A new feature film about hip-hop, love, gentrification, Israeli colonialism, and the Palestinian struggle has been racking up awards and glowing reviews around the world. Junction 48, directed by Udi Aloni, stars Tamer Nafar of the groundbreaking Palestinian hip-hop group Dam, who also co-wrote the screenplay with Oren Moverman. Nafar plays Karim, a rising hip-hop artist living in the city of Lid near Tel Aviv in present-day Israel. In a 2015 article about ongoing home demolitions in Lid, contributor to the Electronic Intifada, Badur Hassan recalls that Lid was the site of one of the worst episodes in the Nakba, Israel's 1948 ethnic cleansing of Palestine. In July of 1948, some 50,000 Palestinians were driven out by Zionist militias and expelled to the West Bank. Many died from exhaustion and dehydration on the way. Nearly 70 years later, Hassan writes, ongoing demolitions of Palestinian homes in Lid are part and parcel of the right-wing mayor's war against the city's indigenous Palestinians. But those who seem to be the most systematically targeted and pay the heaviest price are often women. And in Lid, there's even a wall separating the Palestinian and Jewish neighborhoods, another manifestation of Israel's apartheid policies. The ongoing Nakba inspires the storyline in Junction 48, and Karim's character is inspired by Tamer Nafar's real life. The script highlights a lot of the struggles that he and Dam have been rapping about for years: poverty, crime, police brutality, racism, sexism, and expanding settler colonialism against Palestinians inside present-day Israel. In the beginning, Karim is reluctant to define his songs as political, but as a series of events both tied to him personally and to his direct circle of friends brings pain and loss, we see Karim take risks for his art and his community and the broader liberation struggle for Palestinians. And there's a really intense, deeply nuanced love story in there as well. It's a beautiful, captivating film all around. I was delighted to speak with both Tamer Nafar and director Udi Aloni last week in two separate interviews. They've been traveling around the world with Junction 48. First, we hear from Tamer Nafar, who joined us from his home in Lid. Tamer, you're an old friend of mine. It's so great to have you back with us here on the Electronic Intifada podcast.
Shukran, Nora. Thanks for having me.
You tackle quite a lot of issues in this film, living and struggling in Lid. Maybe, you know, could be seen as a microcosm of a lot of the struggles of Palestinians, whether as citizens of Israel or in the occupied West Bank and Gaza Strip. In the film, we see what happens to communities and families in Lid who are facing home demolitions, as well as casual and overt Zionist racism, police violence, etc. Can you tell us about the interconnection between all of these issues and why you felt it was important to have them make an appearance throughout the story in Junction 48?
I think in general, if there are movies, then it's mostly about the West Bank. Me as a 48er, I always felt left out, not just only in the cinema. We hardly have two movies. We have Ajami and we have Sijil Ikhtifa of Ilya Sliman. So I always felt left out. Even when they talk about the peace process, the 48ers are not part of the negotiation. So normally we are left out. And for me, it was impossible to accept, because if you mentioned the house demolition, we are talking about 300 house demolitions only in Lid. So it was very important for me to do like every artist likes to do, document document my generation and document my environment.
You said that the story was inspired by your life. Tell us a little bit about what compelled you to write these plots, like the home demolitions and Zionist racism in the nightclubs. Why were these important stories for you to tell as a screenwriter?
Actually, to be honest, at the beginning, I wanted to do a ghetto movie because Lid is like a ghetto. You know, I grew up in hip hop. I've watched Boyz II Men. I've watched Fresh and City of God. I like these movies when it comes to criminal series. So I really wanted to keep it. At the beginning, when we started writing it, my direction was mostly the neighborhood itself. And then we felt that something is missing. And Udi said that as a Jewish director, I cannot do a movie without taking responsibility for the Nakba. So that's where the house of Abu Talal came in. And this whole story of demolishing the house to build the coexisting museum. And the idea came just to show how the beautiful Israel, the beautiful the only democracy in the Middle East is building itself over ugliness. So yes, there is no house demolition in Lid that will be replaced by coexistence museum. But if you go to the history of Palestine itself, you can see that Israel did demolish the Muslim cemetery in Jerusalem to build the Museum of Suvlanut, they call it. I forgot the name in English.
Museum of Tolerance, right.
The Museum of Tolerance. So it is. That's what I said. It's not based on, but it's inspired of. And I think that this whole, you know, it's weird because at the same time that the movie dropped, Elias Khoury dropped his, released his book, Ulad El Ghetto, that it discusses, I don't know if you heard of it, but it discusses discusses Lid in 1948, about a character named Adam in 1948, exactly strictly after the occupation itself. And I think that somehow Karim in Junction 48 is the sequel of what happened in the Nakba in a way. Because the Nakba, as we said, the Nakba Mustamirra, yani.
That's the voice of Tamer Nafar. He is the star of the new feature film called Junction 48. Tamer, I mentioned that there's a love story here as well in the film between Karim and Manal, who's an artist in her own right. And as I was watching the film for a second time this past week, it occurred to me that this relationship between them could also be a metaphor, a symbol for the love of Lid, the love of Karim's community and the struggle for freedom there. I may be totally off track, but in writing these scenes between your character and the character of Manar, what were you trying to portray?
Well, first of all, Manar's role is being played by the amazing Samar Kupti. And Samar was the assistant of the director. She was actually trying to get girls to audition for Manar until she said, that's it, I want to try, I want to give her a shot. And that's what made it very cool. I don't think there's a metaphor. I'm glad you liked it. I'm glad you saw it that way. But for me, it wasn't a metaphor. It was very abstract to show that there's also a feminine Nakba. No, there's a feminine Nakba because other than the other than us being oppressed, me as a man, I'm an oppressor as well. So it wasn't a metaphor for nothing. It was just me trying to show to take responsibility. For the things that I do wrong as a man, not as an Arab man, but as a man, because I think chauvinism is an international thing. So for me, there was no metaphor. For me, it was just trying to show my responsibility on this case.
And other characters as well, you know, come up in the early parts of the film. You have two Jewish Israeli rappers who make an appearance.
If you want to talk about a metaphor for me again,
yeah.
Because me and Udi might disagree, me and Oren might disagree about what was the intention, but for me, one of the strongest metaphor characters in the movie is the mother itself, in Karim.
Yeah. Talk a little bit about her, and she's such a complex character. At the beginning of the film, it's very different from who she is at the end. Can you talk a little bit about her and the inspiration for the mother character?
Well, it's not like I'm gonna do a spoiler. It's not like the
don't give any away.
No, it's not. It's not that type of movie of the Sixth Sense where Bruce Willis is dead the whole movie. It's something different. For me, the mother is when we started writing about the mother, it always gave me a reflection of one of Saramago's books, the blindness book, Blindness, where everybody goes blind and only the mother, only the wife's doctor is the only one who can see. And that was Saramago's way to show us that women have a better point of view to the world than men. And for me, that was the mother. That was that was the mother in Karim.
Yeah.
Because for me, for example, when she starts as a communist, after she goes through a trauma in her life, she becomes on a wheelchair, and she becomes more religious, and she becomes more she exorcises demons.
Yeah, she's like mystical,
More mystical, yeah. And one of the best scenes for me is when she goes to exorcise demons from a Jewish family. I don't know if you noticed, but when she goes to the girl, the haunted girl, it's a Jewish family. It's a Mizrahi Jewish family.
Right.
And for me it was one of the best metaphors in the movie when soon as they get into the house, the mother looks at the boys, Karim and Hussam, played by the great Ayad Fadel, and she tells the boys, stay out. That means you men f***ed it up enough. That's enough. You stay out of it. So she goes in alone, of course, with the Manar. And you can see the sisterhood there between Manar, which she's more liberal, and the mother, she's more religious. And the Jewish girl who's haunted, you don't know what she is. And the Jewish mother, the Mizrahi Jewish mother, which is she's also religious. And to see the sisterhood inside without men inside, it's amazing. Poverty unite them, and the sisterhood. And of course, we all know that Mizrahi people are oppressed here. But to keep it more precise, you have the layers over there. You have the Mizrahi women standing, and you have the mother even on a lower layer. She's sitting on the wheelchair. So she's, even if there's oppression between Mizrahis, and even if there's oppression with the Mizrahim and with the Palestinians, you can see that the Palestinians are in a lower point. And that's why they have the right to fix the world. Because I think that the world will not be saved by a white man or rich people. I think these guys fuck the world, and it should be the opposite. I think that the solution should come from the bottom. And I think that's one of the best metaphors, to exorcise the demons, to exorcise ISIS, to exorcise Trump, to exorcise Obama even. I don't see a big difference. Or to exorcise Hillary Clinton or Bibi or Assad or Putin. I think that only people that comes from down. They see everything, and they are sensitive even more. So that's for me, that's the metaphoric thing there.
I was also struck by these like caricatures of these Zionist rappers that you encounter in the nightclub. They have these like really boring nationalistic songs about Zionism. The crowd in the club seems not to question or challenge or even be like affected by the lyrics. And Karim brushes them aside as well until Manar confronts him and the whole situation inside that club. Can you talk about the hip-hop scene in present-day Israel and how, as a Palestinian rapper from Lid, you've come across these types of young nationalistic Zionist rappers? How realistic is that scene and the discussions that Zionist rappers have with their audiences or none at all or with other MCs?
Well, the mainstream hip-hop years ago was the Israeli mainstream hip-hop was more I don't want to generalize, but the mainstream, the biggest stars, they, for me, they were very fascist. But nowadays, hip-hop here is, the Israeli hip-hop here is more, it's less political, but it's more like positive. But I think I like a lot of them, by the way, and I play a lot of them and I enjoy their music. But I think it's in a way that they reached a point where, you know, where the Palestinians are separated in a wall. They don't bother them anymore. They are stuck somewhere. So somehow they can enjoy their life by bringing Beyonce, by bringing everything while the Palestinians are being screwed. So somehow it gave them the point of being not nationalist enough. They are beyond that for me. But back in the days when the story takes a place, like in 2004, let's say 2005, I think that's where the story takes a place. Yes, there was, you know, it was after the Second Intifada, and it was more nationalist. And it's funny because I remember a lot of scenes where I'm going to perform in an Israeli club, for example, in Tel Aviv, and I remember them singing about the army and how great the army is, and we should all recruit the army, and they were wearing the Muhammad Ali Clay shirt. So I think it was, yeah, it was, you know, it's just schizophrenia, but I would say it's more funny, it's more sad. I don't think that the Israel hip hop, the nationalist one, I don't think it have self-awareness in a way. I don't think it can make, it sounds like a white rapper in the segregation days. That's what it sounds like.
Yeah. And Karim's character, you know, he doesn't seem that affected by it at first, but you see this growth, this very rapid growth throughout the film, where he, you know, he becomes political just on the basis of, you know, what's happening around him.
Well, let's face it, at the beginning, when he goes to the club, he's just happy to see the speakers. He just did a show at a birthday for kids, for babies. So for him, at Manar's cousin's house. So she comes from a very, she comes from an aristocrat family. She comes from where she doesn't need that. And for him, he just stepped out of the neighborhood. And for the first time in his life, he sees lights, he sees a microphone, and he sees rappers. And he's just like the rappers that he grew up with. And for him, he doesn't care about the lyrics. For him, it's like, wow, finally, hip. Because he cares about music, more about politics. So Manar allows herself to be judgmental and to be, what are you listening to that? Because she's not missing that thing like he is, you know? So that's why it takes him time to understand what she's talking about. You know, I always remember, when we talk about, you know, poor people that comes from a poverty place that they don't want to be political. It reminds me of a Kendrick Lamar line, you know, because she's a prostitute, and when she wants to have sex, she does it in the back seat, right? So she jumps to the back seat, and nothing really matters. So she hit the back seat. Rosa Parks never affect her when she was making the ends meet. And I think that's a line that we should remember when people that comes from poverty decides not to be political. I think they're trying to make ends meet. They're just trying to live. And that's why the prostitute in the Kendrick Lamar song, she just hits the back seat and she doesn't care about Rosa Park. She just want to make money now. So for Karim, that was it at this point. But of course, it takes time until, not because Manar is so powerful for him, but because he loves her. And it sounds different when she say it. If one of his friends said it, I don't think he would give a damn. But if she said it, it's different. Manar really motivates. Manar and the mother are the key characters in the movie. They just shape Karim.
Tamer, let's talk about the reception that Junction 48 has had in Europe and in the U.S. and in Palestine, including in Israel. What kinds of reviews has it gotten so far, especially from Palestinian audiences?
Oh, I can remember. I can remember two specific quotations that we got on Facebook. One by a girl with hijab. She wrote that she's used to go to that main, because that was the first Arabic movie to reach the mainstream cinema here. And I'm talking about Tel Aviv, Herzliya, Rishon, Haifa, Nasra. Even Jenin and Ramallah. So it was in Ramallah for like 2 months in the mainstream cinema. And one of the girls wrote that she went to Rishon, a Jewish city, to watch a movie because that's the closest one to Ramleh and Lod. She said, I went there and at the same screen that I always watch movies where Arabs are terrorists or Arabs are backwards people. Suddenly I see a movie where the bad guy in the movie is an Arab and the good guy in the movie is an Arab, like every normal society in the world. So that was very emotional for me to see us functioning like a real society. Like we have bad people and we have good people. And that was one. And there's another one that I got from a Jewish girl that watched it in Jerusalem. She said that for the first time in her life, she steps into a movie and it's half Palestinians and half Israelis. And she said that when the Israeli rappers sings the Israeli song, all the Jewish crowds starts clapping. And when Manar sings about No Tengo Lugar about Palestine, all the Arabs start clapping. And when the house is demolished, everybody is quiet. So I think that was one of the most, these two are the strongest ones that I got.
What's it like for you to hear that? What's it like for you to see these audiences, not just in Palestine, but around the world? You're just here in the States with Udi. What has it been like here to see these reactions by different audiences?
Me and Udi are not used. Like, we always get attention, but we are not used to get red carpets and these things because we don't do mainstream stuff that normally festivals like. So it was very interesting. Like, we started the movie on February. We opened in February 2016 in the Berlinale. And it was a crowd of 1,000 people. And when the movie ended, they clapped for 11 minutes. They clapped and they Wow. whistled. It was like, yeah, it was like a soccer game. And I was like, okay, I didn't know that people in Germany goes that wild. And when I stepped into the stage, the guy, the festival's manager, he hugged me and he whispered, it's like, it's the first time I see something like this. I was like, okay, that's different. So, and then we won the award. Of the audience award, yeah. And then we went to Tribeca, and then we won Tribeca, and it was all amazing. And then when we decided to open here at the 1st of May, me and Udi decided that we cannot. Okay, we got Tribeca, the Tribeca signature, we got Berlinale signature. We need the lit signature before we start the movie here. So a day before the main screening, we opened a theater and we invited all of lit people to watch it.
And what was that like?
It was amazing. For me, you know, we didn't watch the movie. We stayed outside, me, Udi, and Samar. And we were talking, and then Udi and Samar told me, why are you being so rude and violent with us? So I wasn't like that in Berlinale or Tribeca, but somehow in lit, I felt very tensed. It was very intentional for me because it's people that I know. It's even if I don't know everybody's name, but it's just people I know that I know, and they know, and I know that they will be. So when they watched the movie, it was very personal for them, you know. So I was very moved, very 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 moved. To see them hugging the movie and clapping so hard. And I was like, okay, wow, if your city loves you, and I mean, that's it. That's all I need now.
Yeah. Yeah. They could be your harshest critics and also your, you know, your most beloved fan.
I got the privilege to be the second one.
That's great. Tamer, you've been a hip hop artist for about 20,000 years now. Was acting a natural thing for you, or you know, do you want to keep acting and writing screenplays? Where is this going?
Yes, I would like to do that. I need to find more time for these things. It was very hard for me to do it. At the beginning, I really didn't want to do it. You know, I think that I've been through. I really didn't want. Look, I've been doing the same character for 16 years. I've been standing on stage and I'm being delivering charisma and delivering energy and jumping and yelling and giving jokes like in control. But in the movies, you need to be show your weakness. And I'm really not, rappers are not good at these things. Rappers don't show their weakness normally. And it was very hard for me. But that was the reason that we started the movie. I mean, I've been through a lot of personal shit. And I shared it with my friend back then. He was my friend, Udi. And only, you know, because he's an amazing director. And he said, okay, now that you're ready to show weakness, I think we are ready to make a movie. And that gave me more confidence to do it. It was hard at the beginning for me. Because it's beyond the Israeli borders. It's inside borders that everyone have inside of him. But you know, you just when you trust your partners, and there was a trust, and you know, it's just a process, an amazing process that I would love to do it again in my life.
Finally, your thoughts on the political situation now in Palestine, as you know, as the Israeli government continues to steal Palestinian land, invade Palestinian cities, towns, and villages, hunt and kill Palestinian youth, and enact laws against activists who support the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement. What are you watching closely right now, and what keeps you going?
Nothing, actually. I think we are running out of fuel, to be honest. It's going really hard. I don't know if it's harder on... I don't know. It's just hard times nowadays. I think that Israel has been like that always. I think now they have the guts to get out of the closet. I don't know where is it going. I don't think it's good, especially with the collapse of the Arabic world as well. So I really don't know. All I know is that I have my close artist friends. And we are just, you know, maintaining to create. And, you know, when the world pressed restart, you know, that's what I say in my new song. Like that the U.S. government and the Western world made us flee floods. So now I'm in my Middle East art. I'm in my Middle East art collecting street arts, waiting for the war to restart. So that is what's happening now. We're just trying to save the normality, the normal people, and the people who really wants a change, until the world collapses and we'll just start a new generation. It sounds very optimistic and pessimistic at the same time, yeah. But I really don't know. I don't think it's good for now.
Well, Tamer Nafar, you're a hip-hop legend from Palestine, an actor and a screenwriter. Thank you so much for being with us on the Electronic Intifada podcast.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Between the Lines.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Gerald Friedman, professor of economics at the University of Massachusetts, who assesses the winners and losers in the proposed Republican Party health care plan. An excerpt of a speech by Joe Day Gowdy, chairman of the Yakama Nation in Washington State, delivered at the Native Nations Rise March and Rally in Washington, D.C. And L.A. Kaufman, a veteran organizer, strategist, journalist, and observer of U.S. radical politics, who talks about her new book titled Direct Action, which offers useful lessons for today's Trump resistance movement. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The smiling face of Donald Trump fills a billboard in the Serb-majority town of North Mitrovica, Kosovo. Serbs, who are a minority in Kosovo, were elated when Trump beat Hillary Clinton in last November's election. Many still hate Bill Clinton, who, as U.S. president in the 1990s, led bombing campaigns against Serb military forces in Bosnia and Kosovo during the violent breakup of the former Yugoslavia. Since a peace deal was signed in the Balkans, new ethnic tensions have resurfaced amid calls to reopen debate over borders and potential land swaps. In Bosnia, the autonomous Serb Republic regularly threatens to hold a referendum for independence. According to the Guardian newspaper, some Bosnian Serbs have supported the idea of boycotting the central government in Sarajevo, which has not accepted a ruling by the International Court of Justice, clearing Serbia of complicity in genocide during the Bosnian War. Conflicts between Albanians and Serbs never ended in the Balkans. One human rights activist observed, "It's Israel and Palestine in Europe." Western diplomats now worry 2017 may become a nightmare year with elections in Serbia and the growing likelihood of a snap poll in Kosovo. Indictments are also expected from a special court in The Hague, adjudicating crimes committed by members of the Kosovo Liberation Army, whose leaders now serve in Kosovo's political establishment. The U.S. Export-Import Bank has provided $315 million in financing to the New Jersey-based Connell Company, which sold equipment to mines in Africa accused of exploiting slave labor and of committing other human rights abuses. The financing deals from 2007 to 2015 involved 17 mining companies in sub-Saharan Africa. The Connell Company used U.S. taxpayer financing to supply equipment to the Bisha copper mine in Eritrea, which is under investigation by a Canadian court over accusations of using slave labor. The Canadian mining company Nevsun Resources, which runs the Bisha mine, faces a class action suit claiming Nevsun used the army to force military conscripts to work in their mine. The Connell Company, a family-owned conglomerate founded in 1926, is one of the largest recipients of financing from the Export-Import Bank, along with banking giants like Wells Fargo and J.P. Morgan Chase. According to the Center for Responsive Politics, the Connell Company donated almost $5.8 million to U.S. politicians from 1990 to 2016. After Donald Trump was nominated for president, Virginia activist Brittany Scherer decided it was time to commit to running for the state Senate. Scherer, an academic advisor at Old Dominion College, is not alone. Young women have flooded political training programs since Trump was elected in November, many concerned about reproductive rights and climate change. The new wave of feminist political activism comes just in time for the Democratic Party, which has lost control of the majority of state houses across the country. The current enthusiasm of women interested in running for local office is similar to what occurred in 1992, when the number of women candidates surged after the sexual harassment claims against Supreme Court Justice nominee Clarence Thomas were dismissed by the majority of the U.S. Senate. The number of women in public office has grown since the 1990s, but has flattened out in recent years. According to the Center for American Women and Politics at Rutgers University, women make up just 19% of the seats in Congress and only 25% of all state legislators. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
President Donald Trump and Republican Party leaders in the House and Senate have followed through on their campaign pledge to repeal and replace Obamacare. But the proposed GOP legislation, dubbed the American Health Care Act, shamelessly fails to live up to Trump's repeated promises on the campaign trail to provide health insurance to all Americans, ensure that all Americans will have quality health care for less money than Obamacare, and to never cut funding for Medicaid. On all three of those important pledges, the Republican health care bill flunks. Analysis of the legislation by the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office projects that 24 million more Americans would be uninsured by 2026 than under Obamacare, including 14 million that would lose their insurance by 2018. While the GOP bill would lower federal deficits by $337 billion over 10 years, largely as a result of cuts to Medicaid that would reduce enrollment, average health insurance premiums would rise by as much as 20% in 2018 and 2019 before falling in later years. If the Republican health care plan were to become law, an estimated 52 million people would be uninsured by 2026, compared to 28 million who lack insurance under the current law. More than 50 national organizations oppose the GOP's proposed health care plan, endorsed by President Trump, including AARP, the American Medical Association, the American Hospital Association, the Federation of American Hospitals, and the American Cancer Society. Your reporter spoke with Gerald Friedman, professor of economics at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst and an economic advisor to Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders during his presidential campaign. Here, Friedman assesses the winners and losers of the proposed Republican Party health care plan.
Well, the plan could very well be seen as wealth care instead of health care. The one definite element in the Republican plan that has persisted throughout all the various permutations is that they're going to repeal all the taxes that fund the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare. And these are taxes that most people do not know about because they're only assessed on people earning over $250,000 a year. So they're getting rid of all the taxes, which is about $500 billion over the next decade. And all of that money is going to the top 1% of American households, most of it going to the top 1/100th of 1%. So those people are getting a lot of money. Now, since you're getting rid of the revenue, you have to find ways to cut spending. And they're doing it by doing away with the subsidies associated with the Affordable Care Act, subsidies that have gone to working people. They go to people earning less than four times the poverty line, which gets up to like $70,000 for families. And most of the subsidies go to people earning much, much less than that. Second, they are saving money by starting in 2020, basically phasing out the Medicaid expansion program that was part of the Affordable Care Act that mostly blue states, but a few Republican-dominated states, expanded Medicaid to cover people up to 140%, 138% of the poverty line, and also did away with all sorts of restrictions on Medicaid. And those two measures, the subsidies for people to buy individual health insurance plans and the Medicaid expansion, account for the dramatic drop in the proportion of Americans without health insurance. At this point, over 90% of Americans have health insurance. So the Affordable Care Act has worked to extend health insurance to people through subsidies for people to buy individual plans and Medicaid expansion. And those are both to be eliminated. The subsidies go right away and the Medicaid expansion after 2020. Also, while they're doing this, things get even worse because they will be pulling the rug out from the whole market structure that's been set up. The Affordable Care Act, by subsidizing people to buy health insurance and requiring that people have health insurance, although that's a requirement that has never been enforced, has established a market for individual health insurance, for people to buy health insurance as individuals. That's a market that pretty much did not exist before, because health insurance companies would look at people like, why do you want to buy health insurance as an individual? It must be that you expect that you're going to be sick. The health insurance companies are ready to walk away from the individual marketplaces if there are no subsidies and no mandate. The Congressional Budget Office, they're all Republicans over there now. The Republicans took over the House and Senate a couple years ago, and they have full control over the Congressional Budget Office. So it's an old Bush administration economist. I'm sure he's competent, but their bias has been to downplay how bad this law is.
A quick question for you.
Yeah.
Several years ago, Dr. Steffi Wohlhandler and David Himmelstein did a study that they published that talked about some 43,000 people would die if Obamacare was repealed because although
there's lots of criticism to go around about the Obamacare system. It essentially gave people insurance and access to preventive health care and saved lives. Do we have any idea what will happen if 24 million people lose their insurance by 2026 under this Republican plan? How many people would lose their lives?
Yeah. Going back to the original study that Will Handler, Himmelstein, and Wilper at Harvard Public Health did, I think it was 2003. I'm not totally sure of the year. But anyway, the original study, you'd basically figure 1,000 people die for every million people who lose health insurance. So if you have 24 million people thrown off health insurance, you'd be expecting about 24,000 more or less extra deaths in 2026. You'd expect 14,000 extra deaths next year. You know, put it in perspective, that's more than the number of Americans who died in 1967 in the Vietnam War. And we'd be doing that every year. People have to think about that, you know, in Congress. You know, how many Americans are you willing to kill?
I wanted to ask you about the possibility that this debacle in healthcare could result in some newfound political energy and popular support for Medicare for all, a single-payer system. Are you optimistic we are going to find ourselves moving towards single-payer in this country anytime soon?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely, for two reasons. The first is the public energy, the resistance energy that's building up against the Trump administration and against the repeal of the Affordable Care Act. And second, destroying the Affordable Care Act is showing that we really need to do something dramatic to improve, to salvage healthcare in America.
That was Gerald Friedman, professor of economics at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst. Find more analysis of the proposed Republican healthcare plan and the single-payer alternative by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. On March 10th, thousands of indigenous people from across the U.S. gathered in Washington, D.C. for the Native Nations Rise March and Rally. The action was preceded by 2 days of prayer and ceremony on the National Mall. The march route went past the Trump International Hotel, where some participants had erected a teepee, and a group of women did a circle dance. The event began as rain turned to snow, and then back to rain, which was described as Mother Earth doing exactly what she's supposed to be doing by a representative of the Piscataway Nation who welcomed everyone to her homeland. The days of protest and prayer were organized by the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe, which continues to fight the Dakota Access Pipeline, as well as the Indigenous Environmental Network and the Native Organizers Alliance. Participants carried banners opposing the Dakota Pipeline, as well as signs calling for Native consent, and not just consultation, for invasive projects on their lands. Following an executive order from Donald Trump, the Dakota Access Pipeline is now proceeding to completion under the Missouri River, but the tribe is still engaged in a court fight to stop it. One of the speakers at a rally across from the White House was Joe Day Gowdy, chairman of the Yakama Nation in Washington State. He read from a proclamation signed by the Yakama and the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe, which opposes what it calls the doctrine of Christian discovery that justifies the invasion and exploitation of Native lands and peoples.
We carry a message and a warning here today. Love the earth. Love the waters of the earth. Love all forms of life. Care for them with deep and abiding honor and respect, and they will sustain you throughout time. However, be forewarned. If you poison and destroy them, they will poison and destroy you. That is natural law. Our ancestors bequeathed to us a sacred birthright of pure, pristine, and healing waters. Their prayerful and ceremonial manner of caring for the earth resulted in the purest rivers, springs, streams, and aquifers in the respective territories of our nations throughout this hemisphere. Our ancestors used their natural and innate intelligence to discern that water provides life force, the spirit upon all which life depends here on Mother Earth. Our ancestors were given and further evolved original instruction, natural laws, and wisdom teachings. Those instructions included the warning, remember, we follow in a prayerful manner These ceremonial and spiritual patterns of thought and behavior enable us to maintain a sacred and right relationship with the natural abundance of Mother Earth, interconnected with all life forms for all future generations. This is our life-sustaining message today. For more than 500 years, however, contrary forces of greed has worked to destroy our natural laws and our love for Mother Earth. They have greatly opposed our nations, our ceremonies, our teachings, and our sacred places in the name and the idea that they call Christendom in Western Europe. The U.S. Supreme Court rulings and other U.S. actions have expressed these opposing forces, claiming a right of Christian sovereignty and dominion over the territories of the nations based upon the idea that Christian nations of Europe acquired jurisdiction over lands over heathens and infidels. The U.S. Justice Department made that exact argument in the U.S. Supreme Court case in 1954, Teton Indians versus the United States. The Justice Department even quoted Genesis 1:28 and the Book of Psalms from the Bible to support the claim of right Christian supremacy. This is a direct contradiction with the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution and the separation of church and state. We reject the pattern of thought and behavior premised on the Credo and Command, love riches and wealth, the Vatican Papal documents, and the colonizing royal charters written by self-described Christian monarchs that brought the Credo and Command here reveal the underlying code of domination and dehumanization used to attack our nations. The code of domination expressed a belief system that is willing to sacrifice everything on the altar of greed, even the sacred waters upon which life depends. To realize the unfortunate truth of this statement, one has to only think of the lead in the brains of the children of Flint, Michigan, where greed and disrespect for life destroyed rivers that once ran so pure you could drink from them, when our indigenous ancestors prayerfully cared for them since time immemorial. The government and corporate forces that oppose us have a great disdain for our organic laws and teachings, because the laws and teachings stand in the way of them fulfilling their love of riches and wealth. Those forces that oppose us are blind to the spiritual nature and the healing qualities of water. For them, water is simply a commodity, a means to create more riches and wealth, or a commodity to waste and destroy in search of riches and wealth. Therefore, we stand here today and offer the following statement as a proclamation. From the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe and the Yakima Nation, we will read this forth and we will call upon all Native nations and all original and free nations of this earth to stand and sign on to this proclamation with us. The original proclamation of life, original nations proclamation. We understand that our Creator has uniquely brought forth our existence. Our creation is of free and original origin, grounded in love and sustained by divine instruction, resulting in an existence and awareness that has materialized since time immemorial on Turtle Island. We understand the ideas of domination and dehumanization, as these ideas are referenced within the divine instructions and warnings we have heeded since time immemorial for our sustained existence as original free peoples and nations. We understand that the inaccurate concept of discovery, formerly referred to as the doctrine of discovery, utilized by the monarchies of Spain and England, have unjustly manifested the idea of domination and dehumanization against our original free peoples and nations. We understand that the doctrine of discovery by historical monarchies was justified by unholy instruction issued by writ of papal bulls. We understand the dominating and dehumanizing force of manifest destiny utilized in the executive, legislative, and judicial formation of America. We understand the specific reference of the flawed and unholy idea of the doctrine of discovery in the origin of federal Indian law, cited in the Johnson versus McIntosh ruling by the U.S. Supreme Court in 1823 and reaffirmed in 1955 by the Supreme Court ruling Teton Indians versus United States. We understand the judicial precedent of the unchallengeable domination that is being utilized by America's judicial, executive, and legislative branches in the modern-day disputes with original and free peoples and nations, such as Standing Rock's fight with the advocacy of clean water. We understand that the negative ideas of domination and dehumanization warned about to our collective original free peoples and nations by and through divine instruction is the same negative idea that has been utilized by the Roman Catholic Church, the monarchies of Spain and England, and the United States of America.
That was Joe Day Gowdy, chairman of the Yakima Nation. This segment was recorded and produced by Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus. Find more information on the Native Nations Rise Action and organized indigenous resistance by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The 1960s and early 70s was a period of great turmoil and change in the U.S. and around the world. While the decade of the 1950s was identified with conformity and repression, symbolized by Senator Joe McCarthy's anti-communist witch hunts, the 1960s saw a blossoming of powerful social movements. Among these was the critical struggle against racism and for civil rights, massive protests to end America's wars in Southeast Asia, and the birth of new movements for women's equality and the coming out of the LGBT community. A new book, titled Direct Action, Protest and the Reinvention of American Radicalism by L.A. Kaufman, captures the voices of activists and leaders from a wide range of movements that have roots in the 1960s and 70s. The book traces the links between these radical movements over four decades and the evolution of strategies and tactics they employed to change the national debate and transform America. Importantly, Direct Action also highlights the central role of women and queer organizers, as well as the enduring racial divisions that have shaped progressive activism. Your reporter spoke with L.A. Kaufman, a veteran organizer, strategist, journalist, and observer of U.S. radical politics for more than 30 years, about the history covered in her new book, which she explains offers many useful lessons for today's Trump resistance movement.
When I look at the history of these movements and these organizing traditions unfolding over the course of this 40-year period, I see time and time again that the people who have functioned as the bridges between movements, who have brought the skills and the tactics and the organizing techniques, including some of the ones like affinity groups and spokes councils and consensus decision making, the people who have carried that knowledge and those practices from movement to movement have been disproportionately women and disproportionately queer women. And that is just an observation based on decades of being in movements, of who, if you look at the through lines from the anti-nuclear movement to the Central America work and then to ACT UP, for instance, most of the men in ACT UP were political novices. It was the lesbians in ACT UP who were the folks who had done Central America work or who had been part of the women's peace encampments and brought all of these organizing skills. And so I think it's very fitting that as I say, it was kind of the kickoff party or the coming out for the resistance, the Women's March, which was, really a decentralized mobilization. People really self-mobilized. It had many different voices in it and is led by women. I've been incredibly, repeatedly surprised by the breadth and scope of the resistance that's emerging now. We're obviously facing an unprecedented challenge, but the scale and character of what I'm seeing is so different from anything I've seen in decades. It's so much broader. It's so much kind of livelier. It's coming in from so many unexpected quarters that although we're facing challenges like I've never seen, I feel encouraged that our movements are going to continue to resist strongly as Trump attempts to implement his policies and are going to be thinking very strategically about 2018 and 2020 and the longer road ahead.
In terms of the challenges for the Trump resistance movement, it seems that keeping up the high energy and the just incredible momentum that has built up in these last couple of months is difficult, is certainly a challenge, as well as sustaining that movement and that energy over the long haul. Do you have any advice for activists and organizers about the lessons that you've taken away from your living and working through the history of these last 40 years of radical movements?
Well, obviously people need to pace themselves and think about self-care and you know, be judicious in not burning themselves out in the short run. But there are times that require more of us, that ask us to do more and stretch ourselves farther. I think people are already doing that, and I think that's what we have to continue doing. We know that protest movements can be quite effective, and right now, civil society is the only check on the Trump administration, really, that there is. So I encourage people to, yes, be thoughtful about their participation so they can think about the long run, but to understand that these are such extraordinary times that it's a time for all of us to see what we can do to stretch ourselves and be a little bolder and really persist, because that's what victories come from.
That was L.A. Kaufman, a veteran organizer, strategist, journalist, and observer of U.S. radical politics for more than 30 years, talking about her new book titled Direct Action, Protest and the Reinvention of American Radicalism. Find links to Kaufman's website and related articles by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.
Beginning. It has begun. Today marked the second day since I began the treatment regimen of direct-acting antiviral drugs, or DAADs, designed to eliminate hepatitis C from my system. You, the people, made this possible. You, the people, filled two courtrooms in Scranton in December 2015. You, the people, supported our lawyers, Brett Grote of Abolitionist Law Center of Pittsburgh, and Bob Boyle of New York City, as well as Dr. Joseph Harris, M.D., who diagnosed me as I was nodding in and out in a wheelchair in a prison visiting room, and later served as an expert witness in our hearings in Scranton. You, the people, sent love, prayers, letters, cards, money, and strength to us all, for which the words "I thank you" seem pale in comparison, yet I thank you still. You, the people, are helping me heal. The battle isn't over, but this is a damn good beginning. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, The Michael Slate Show.
That's good. That's good. That feels really good to get in here and to sit down and have that music, and it just sets me off, all right? And I'm going to be real quick today because we have a hell of a show for you. It's three really packed segments, all right? Back on the back end, we're going to be talking with Brant Olson, the executive director of climatetruth.org, and it's one of the groups that helped organize the Stand Up for Science rally in San Francisco and is assisting the March for Science. And we'll be talking about the March for Science on April 22nd in Washington, D.C., and with satellite marches in over 430 other cities. Before that, we will be joined by Josh Willis, oceanographer and climatologist and principal investigator of Oceans Melting Greenland. All right, this is not a segment to miss, all right, or to snooze through, because if you remember, I've had him on a couple of other times, and he's always got something very interesting and compelling to say. Plus, he punches me in the nose if nobody is listening, okay? So please, please stay tuned on that one, all right? But opening the show up, I'm very pleased to be bringing you an interview I did just a little while ago with Robert Shankin. Robert is the person who wrote the play Building the Wall, and he wrote it in 7 days last fall as the election loomed. He's talking about why he wrote it, the effort to have it performed as widely as possible. And Robert is a Pulitzer Prize and Tony Award-winning playwright and an Academy Award-nominated screenwriter. And I'm not going to say much more because I want you to actually hear the interview, and then we'll be back after that. So here's my interview with Robert Shankin. Robert, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Yeah. Your play just is blowing a lot of minds. It's an extremely, extremely important piece out in the world today. And I want to talk to you about some of the things that really hit me about it. So let's jump into it. Let's start by talking about the birth of the play. You said that you wrote it in a white hot fury and finished in a week. What is it that compelled you to do this?
Well, this was in late October as one of the more dispiriting presidential campaigns lurched to a close. I was extremely angry and anxious at what I was hearing and how it was being treated in the press. I thought that the then Republican presidential candidate's rhetoric was quite deliberately incendiary and had crossed a serious line. And I kept hearing fairly respected commentators, press, as well as politicians, trying to reassure us that he didn't mean it, or that it was just words, or that they would protect us. And I didn't believe that. I thought that regardless of how the election turned out, and I will be honest, I expected a different result, but I thought, however the election turned out, that we had already crossed a serious line politically and culturally, and I needed to respond to that as an artist. And so I sat down and I wrote this play in a week. That is a bit faster than my normal process, which can take several months or even several years. But I had such a strong impulse here and such a sense of urgency about the situation. I felt then, and even more today, that we are in the middle of an unfolding political crisis, the magnitude of which I certainly have never seen in my lifetime, and I doubt the Republic has in 100 years. Certainly not in terms of such an internal threat.
Mm-hmm. Let's go a little further with this because, you know, it's interesting when you're talking about what drove you to write it. And actually, when you see it, well, the play is situated in the aftermath of the Trump regime to a certain extent, and it has a certain progression built on the most horrendous and terrible things that were done. You've argued, though, that this is not some kind of wild-ass science fiction here, that in many ways it's the logical conclusion of where things are headed. And I think your point about just seeing the way it's rolling out, there is a logic to the way it's falling out. And let's talk about that in relation to you doing this play.
Oh, absolutely. The play is set in the near future, fall of 2019, and you could call it speculative fiction. But I would argue that the alternate reality that I've envisioned here is one that could very easily be brought into being, and that what we are seeing right now, in the early months of this new political regime, while startling and infuriating and scary is not new. This is a page out of a very old handbook, the Authoritarian Handbook. The process here is pretty straightforward. You make the populace feel afraid and isolated and anxious. You position yourself as the strong leader who is the only person capable of rescuing them. There are appeals to nativism and racism, scapegoating of minorities, racial, religious, and a consolidation of power and the diminution of personal liberties. When the President of the United States describes the free press, the American press, as an enemy of the people, a phrase so toxic that Nikita Khrushchev could not bring himself to use it at the height of the communist power in the 60s, we have already gone a long ways down a dark road. And people need to be very conscious of what's happening.
Mm-hmm. It's heavy to me, too, because the way you present this, it's all very compelling and challenging, your approach in terms of the content of the thing. And you have these two characters. And frankly, the interaction between the two, there's sort of an edge to it. But then there's also a way that they're really exploring where each other is coming from to a certain extent. There's a lot going on in terms of the confrontation and interaction between those two characters themselves that are arguing out arguments that are taking place in the society and that are very, very organically tied up with what you just said about this being this just unfathomable crime against humanity.
Well, thank you. That's certainly what I intend to do here. The play's not intended to be a polemic. I'm actually trying to get at some complicated ideas that we are struggling with, some complicated issues that are not black and white. There's a reason why people who would not normally have voted for our current president did during this election. And this had to do with very real economic and societal failures. And that creates the conditions in which this kind of authoritarian figure can arise. It's very important to understand that. Not to excuse, but to understand so that we can solve the underlying problem and hopefully change the circumstances under which we're currently struggling. So, yes, with these two characters who are different in many ways, he's a blue-collar managerial type who ran a private prison, and he's white male. The other character, Gloria, is an African-American female who's a professor of history. And they come together in this one moment. Rick has been convicted of some unspecified but obviously pretty serious crime and is awaiting sentencing. And interestingly, Gloria is the only person that he is allowed to interview him. And so they're both here in this cell trying to understand history, trying to understand what happened. And to some degree, Rick is honestly struggling as much as Gloria is to understand what he's done and what the consequences are. And these people, like all people, come into this room with certain set of expectations and stereotypes about the other person and the other person's politics. And these are confounded and surprised over again. And both people are forced to recognize more than once how limited their understanding is, how narrow their perspective is, and how complicated people are. That's quite intentional. The play is intended to appeal to a very broad audience and to play regardless of your politics or whether you're urban or rural or blue state or red state, because it speaks to a very fundamental human condition. The challenge here, as the challenge always is, between the conscience of the individual and the power of the state. This is a struggle that's central to the dynamic tension of democracy. Aeschylus was exploring this 2,000 years ago. It's still true today. We like to think of our democracies as vibrant and healthy and strong, and yet we're seeing very clearly, and not just in the United States, but in Europe as well, how fragile they are, really, how easily it is to wobble, to spin off course, and how important, how even more important it is then for citizens to exercise their moral principle, their moral choice, and not cede that authority to the authorities.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with playwright and screenwriter Robert Chaykin, and we're talking about his new play, Building the Wall. I want to follow up on that a little bit, too, because one of the things that struck me, and I've heard a number of people wrestling with the content of the play, and then some people will start, they'll try to like get into and understand, in quotes, understand why Rick does what he does, mm-hmm. this heinous stuff that he does. And to me, what came across more in your play was this point about basically there's no understanding in terms of there's no forgiveness when somebody actually does this. And I keep thinking about Nasty Girl, that film Nasty Girl, where she went back to Germany and she went to the village where her grandparents lived or something. And she starts talking to all these people, and all these people had done the most horrendous things, turning mm-hmm. in their neighbors and everybody to the Gestapo mm-hmm. and people being slaughtered and tortured. And no one wanted to talk about it and pretended it was all in the past, or maybe it was necessary for us to do. But I thought that what you do with this, the way you work out this struggle here, is that people are challenged not to forgive, even if you're saying, okay, you want people to understand how this happens. It's not a question of forgiving somebody like that, because there actually were crimes against humanity that are being dealt with here. That's very heavy. I'd like to talk with you about that. And linked to that is that the point that you've quoted a couple of times where you say that old quote about the only thing necessary for the triumph of evil is that good men do nothing.
Well, it's very true. I was just reading an interesting article the other day in the newspaper, a review of a book talking about the Gestapo and how actually the number of members of the Gestapo, the Nazi Germany police force, are astonishingly small given the size of the population, and that they managed to intimidate and control something like 3,800 citizens for every single Gestapo agent. Well, obviously, it's not that single agent is in contact with every one of those 3,800 people and every moment of the day. So what's keeping them in line? And what's obviously keeping them in line and keeping them intimidated and keeping them subservient is their own concession to the state. And that's a critical notion, that they gave their power away. They ceded their power to the authorities. And even if they were not explicitly active in the criminal activities that were perpetuated by their regime, they were implicitly involved because they didn't say no, because they didn't stand up. They didn't take a stand. And that's a very, very important thing to keep in mind. We actually, as citizens, have more power than we think, and certainly more power than the authorities would like us to believe. In order, in a democracy, for a political ideology to be translated into social policy and practical action, it requires the buy-in of enormous numbers of people. And if that buy-in doesn't happen, then the policy doesn't happen. And that means that lots and lots of individuals acting as individuals and then as groups have taken a stance against it. We just saw this recently in the voting down of the repeal and replace of Obamacare in the House. They tried to force a crazy quilt Frankenstein of a bill, which would have had horrendous consequences. And the pushback was so intense from ordinary citizens who just got in their faces that they backed down. They couldn't even hold the vote because it would have been so embarrassing. That's the power of an informed, aroused citizenship. And that's the important thing in a democracy.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with playwright and screenwriter Robert Chaykin, and we're talking about his new play, Building the Wall. Let me ask you this, Robert, because it's one of the things that gets to me is that when you're talking about this, a friend actually told me, we were talking about the play and we were talking about, well, sometimes there's people arguing that, well, Rick's circumstances led him to do this. And he was really anguished and he was really struggling around it. And I kept arguing with people, but he did it. You know, people get worried about this and they think about like, well, he isn't a monster. So maybe that means he couldn't do monstrous things. And I kept thinking, well, no, people have done many monstrous things, including if you think back to the times of the lynchings in this country, where many, many white people came together and we're not getting our jobs. We're being screwed over by these black people are taking all this stuff. And they're out there lynching people. You know, it's people, other people are trying to understand why they did it. Well, there actually are times that when people basically, they decide that they are going to do things that are, in fact, crimes against humanity. Even if they don't think that they are, they can see what's actually doing. If you're going out and you're lynching somebody or you're helping someone do whatever, you're helping mm-hmm. them get into the gas chambers, right. That's a problem.
Right. Well, we are all of us the hero of our own play. We rarely think or admit that we might be wrong or that our motives might be less than pure. It requires a very, very strong constitution and conscience to be able to examine one's motives and one's action in an objective manner, but it's critical that we attempt that. Rick's slow progression here to Golgotha is full of half steps and quarter steps that in and of themselves make sense, sort of, don't seem necessarily bad in the moment, but cumulatively, we can see that he's going down a certain kind of path and the consequences of which are dire and, as you suggest, ultimately unforgivable. The only way one avoids that, and this is what the play's ultimate argument is, the only way one avoids that is by staying very conscious in your life. It's critical to stay awake, to be aware of what's happening. It's so easy, and the human tendency to avoid unpleasantness or deny unpleasantness is almost overwhelming. It's part of how we're hardwired, particularly a threat that doesn't appear immediate. You know, it's fascinating. I don't know if you saw this recent article in the New York Times about American citizens and their perceptions of climate change. There's actually now a fairly sizable majority, 70%+, who agree with the statement that climate change is happening and it's man-made. But what's fascinating is only 20% of those same people feel that it's having any impact on them. And therein lies the dichotomy and the terrible, terrible problem that we're facing, which is we're not feeling the consequences of our actions nearly acutely enough. And as a consequence, we're not able or willing or ready to change our actions, even though we are setting in motion terrible forces which, once unleashed, may never be able to be recaptured. But that's the human condition, and it requires a real effort to surmount that, to be awake, to be aware, and to make our choices consciously.
Let me ask you this. In this play, and when you write about the play, you go into talking about, I don't know if I'll pronounce her name right, Gita Sarene?
Yes, I think that's how it's pronounced.
Okay. And you go
not
into
sure.
And her book, Into That
yes.
Darkness, and what you learned from it. And I wanted to talk to you about that because it seems that what I was able to gather from what I saw you say about it, it has a lot to do with this point we're just talking about, related to the point that you make about how it's not so much what authorities do, but how people respond. Tell us about Gita Sarene's book and the impact it had on you and how it's related to that point.
Yes, this is a kind of a classic now in Holocaust literature, and I just stumbled across it. I couldn't even tell you how. It is an investigation into the life and times of this one individual who, for a brief moment, became extremely powerful in the Nazi death machinery. And she spends almost 60 hours interviewing him, but she also interviews his wife and family members and colleagues and people who survived him. And it's a real attempt to come to sort of grips with how did you wind up doing these kinds of things. And it was very, very provocative and very illuminating. For me personally, my grandfather, who was a Dutch Jew who immigrated in the 1920s, not just out of economic necessity, but also because I think he saw the coming cloud of fascism. And he lost 16 family members in the Holocaust. And the loss was so painful that he actually never spoke of it to me. I did not know this part of my family history until I discovered it by accident in my 30s. That's how painful and profound the loss was, the wound was. And I know that reading that book, which I did almost a year ago, certainly had an influence in me and certainly found some expression in the play that I've written.
Mm-hmm. Now, my final question. You've said that you wanted to get this play out as widely as possible, which you really put a great effort into doing, and I hope it spreads all over the country. And in fact, you've even described this time now as similar to the last days of the Weimar Republic in Germany, which I was really glad to see somebody's finally. Yes, it is similar to the last days of the Weimar Republic. And for people that don't know, that regime, the Weimar regime, was the one that was defeated by Hitler in Germany, opening the door for Hitler to come into power in Germany. But to me, that lends this whole thing a proper sense of urgency in this. And I'd like you to talk about what you see, because when you talk about this as the last days of the Weimar Republic, and you see you pose that before people who are maybe doubting that or half-stepping around all this, myself, I think that lends it exactly the right amount of urgency. Let's talk about that.
I feel that the situation right now is extremely urgent. I feel that the political crisis, and I'm using my words very, very carefully here, the political crisis that we're experiencing is not a conflict between Republicans and Democrats. It's not even a conflict between conservatives and liberals. What we're experiencing is a concerted and very conscious attack on fundamental American values, basic values, the heart of our democracy. I refer, of course, to things like the separation of powers, an independent judiciary, freedom of press, free speech. This is what's under attack. To me, if I was a conservative, I would be just as concerned about that as a liberal. This is what makes our democracy and our republic what it is. And I think what is really worrisome is that we're experiencing this from the executive branch, but those individuals, those leaders, political leaders in the legislative branch, are either silent or essentially lining up in support of what's happening. And that's really scary and appalling. Fortunately, we're seeing a lot of pushback in the judicial branch, and that's reassuring. But there are far too many representatives, both in the House and the Congress and then in state legislators, who have just temporarily shelved their conscience in order to take advantage of this once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to wield elite power. And that's very, very worrisome. And between now and the midterm elections, this is when any new administration is at its powers are at its strongest. So it will really require all of us, I think, to A, be very conscious, B, to make the choices we make, small and great choices, with great moral clarity, and to not cede our moral authority to the establishment.
All right, Robert Shankin, thank you very much on this, man. I really enjoyed talking
to you. Great to talk to you. Appreciate
sure.
it.
Yeah,
thank you.
All right, bye now.
Bye-bye.
All right, we've just been talking with playwright Robert Shankin about his new play, Building the Wall. And for more information on the Rolling World premiere in 6 different cities, check out the National New Play Network, and that's at nnpn.org. And believe me, Robert has said, you just come to him with an idea that you want to put it up, you want to put it in your basement, you want to put it out in the town square, go ahead and do it, all right? This is a play that he really wants to get out there. We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back with the notorious Josh Willis, and you'll find out a lot more about him in case you weren't listening a little while ago when he was on. So stay tuned. Welcome back. That's Breeding Resistance, a.k.a. Paper Tiger Blues from Ted Sirota's Rebel Souls, all right? And you remember Ted, we had him on the show talking about the new group that he formed, political group, bringing in a lot of musicians, a lot of artists called Degenerate Artists, okay? And celebrating, calling on everyone who's an artist to become a degenerate artist. In this system, that's the best thing to be, is degenerate when you're measuring it up against the system. All right, I'm really pleased to welcome back to the show after a considerable absence. But I'm sure he's going to say I was out on a frozen ice pack somewhere. His name is Josh Willis. He's an oceanographer and climatologist, and he's the principal investigator of Oceans Melting Greenland. And we'll talk about that in just a minute. A study was launched in 2015 by NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory, and the study has released some dramatic and disturbing findings about the rate and mechanism of the melting and its contribution to destructive sea level rises. Josh Willis, welcome to the show.
Michael, so good to be here. Thanks for having me.
Okay, I'm going to hold you to that now, too.
All right.
Let's talk about this. I am pulling out the March for Science, and I'm saying, which we'll talk about in a minute. But you just finished, as I understand, you just finished a more recent round of OMG.
Right.
Now, I want you to tell people first, before we get started, what is OMG? And then we can talk about what you were doing in this new round.
Yeah, OMG is a mission we just started a couple years ago. And the goal is to figure out how much the oceans are eating away at the ice in Greenland, because we know Greenland's melting, the planet's warming, humans are causing this warming. But we think about Greenland usually as melting from the top down. The air gets warmer, it melts the surface, and it starts to disappear. But it turns out that a lot of the ice actually sits right in the water. And so the ocean can eat away at it from the edges. And that's what we're trying to measure with OMG.
Hmm. Tell me something. I'm kind of curious about this because I want to know how long that's sort of – has that been going on? You know, because it's a little troubling. You're saying –
Right. Well, the processes have all been there forever. I mean, the ice flows off of the land into the water, and it breaks off in big chunks that are called icebergs. We know what those are. This is part of the normal process, but what's happening is that the melting and the breaking off has exceeded the snowfall every year that happens in Greenland. So every year in the wintertime, it gets cold, it snows, Greenland builds up some extra mass, it gains some weight, just like me over the holidays. And then in the summer, it gets warm, it starts to melt, but that melting and the breaking off is now faster than the snow can add the mass back. So we're seeing Greenland thinning and disappearing, and over the course of 5 or so years, it loses about a trillion pounds at a time. Excuse me, a trillion tons at a time.
Aha. Uh-huh. So you're going to market that, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Go, sit in this water.
Exactly.
But here's a question for you, though, because has this been a constant affair, or is it something that's just recently developed? And when you say Greenland is melting, is it possible that Greenland could disappear altogether?
Well, yeah. I mean, the warming that we've already had makes it pretty likely that Greenland is going to disappear. It's a question of – and when I say Greenland, I mean the ice in Greenland. And that's enough ice to raise sea levels by 20 feet, by the way. So it's a lot. The question is it going to be in 1,000 years, or is it going to be in 100 years, or somewhere in between? And the short answer is we just don't know. And a lot of what we're doing with OMG is trying to narrow that window down and figure out a little bit better just how fast the ice sheet can disappear.
And the thing too, though, is that when you're talking about this, when you're talking about the rise in the ocean level, this is something that's planetary, not just like surrounding Greenland.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, you know, 2/3 of our planet is covered with ocean, more than 2/3. And when Greenland melts, that water rises all around. So, you know, you live in Australia, well, you still care whether Greenland is melting, and because that water is going to be on your doorstep too.
You know, I asked that question because I'm one of those people who probably would have been sitting there going, "Ah, oh, it's Greenland, come on."
Yeah, right. I mean,
who's going to miss it? I mean, it is extremely serious when you think about this. And it's like basically that's the process that you're saying is in play right now, right?
That's right. And, you know, what we're seeing is a really rapid melting. If this much melting had been going on for like the last several thousand years, then sea level would already be a lot higher than it is. So we know this is something new. It's happening right now. And the rate at which it's happening is speeding up as we add more CO2 to the atmosphere, trap more heat, and drive our climate into a warmer place than it's been in tens or hundreds of thousands of years.
So now you're sitting here with the Trump regime who says, climate, schlimate. What do I care? You know, and also talks about, you know, I mean, even this thing about – which has always been a problem, including with what they set up in Paris and everything else. Even with all the restrictions and all the falling short that they have in what came out of Paris, they're still – to have that just be chopped away at and hacked away at the way it actually seems it's going to be under the Trump regime. You know, you're looking at this and you're thinking, damn, man, because – this is something that's not, you know, it's not something to be played with. And you're looking at that and it's kind of like when you talk about – I was reading something you wrote recently and I think it had to do with the current rise in ocean levels is from the early 1920s until now.
Yeah, I mean, that's when it's the fastest. So, you know, 100 years ago, sea level was going up at a rate of about 1 millimeter per year. 50 years ago, it was more like 2 millimeters per year. Now it's 3 millimeters per year and climbing. And, you know, once it gets up to 4 or 5 or even 10 millimeters per year, now we're talking about sea level rise that's really going to be destructive really, really quickly. And, you know, these numbers sound small. I get it. You know, it's a few millimeters. You're standing on the beach watching these giant waves roll in. But you have to remember that every inch of sea level rise is like 8 feet of beach loss because the beach is slow.
Say that again.
So every foot of sea level rise is about 8 feet of beach loss on average.
You know, and one of the things what I was trying to squeeze out of my head there is that when you're talking about this thing being that what you're concentrated on is the more recent stuff, but this has been happening generally over a whole historical period, right?
Well, the rise that we see today really began in either the late 1800s or the early 1900s with the Industrial Revolution. We had about 2,000 years of stable sea level rise. So if you keep going back in time to 10 or 20,000 years ago, sea level was much lower because the world was colder. There was a big ice sheet. A lot of the water from the ocean was in that ice. What happened is about 10,000 years ago, that started to melt. Sea levels rose really rapidly and then they stabilized. And we have good records for the last 2,000 years of a stable sea level. We can see back in time 2,000 years and we can see that sea levels were about like they were today or were at 1800 for the previous 2,000 years. And then in the last 100 years, 150 years, they're just shooting up like gangbusters. Mm-hmm. So this is a new thing and it's really tied to the Industrial Revolution. It's really tied to human-caused climate change.
That's what I wanted to hear more of in terms of it being tied to the Industrial Revolution and human-caused climate change. This is an extremely important thing for people to understand.
Yeah, the rise that we see today is pretty much all human-caused. There's not really a background rate of rise that's significant at all. If it was, we would be able to see it in all these other records, but it's not. It's been stable for 2,000 years and then it's shooting up right here at the end. And the other thing is that you got to remember the oceans absorb 90% of the heat that's trapped by the greenhouse gases. So they're really the main repository for storing the extra heat. That means when the oceans warm up, they expand. That causes sea level rise. And then, of course, the glaciers and melting ice sheets cause sea level rise too. So when you look at the rising oceans, it's kind of the most powerful indicator. This is two-thirds of the planet we're talking about changing its shape, growing by an inch a decade or so right now. And it's a huge signal. It's the most obvious signal we have of human-caused climate change.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and today we're talking with Josh Willis, who's from OMG. Actually, you're from – what's that place out in Pasadena?
The Jet Propulsion Laboratory.
Right, exactly. There you go. The Jet Propulsion. And you're, and that – now look – I want people to be sure that they don't think that you're out there on like a ski board or something, some skiing thing, and you're just zipping through whatever they call them. I'm doing really good today.
No, I turned in my rocket boots a long time ago.
Rocket boots, there you go. Dave. But, you know, when you're talking about this, I keep thinking, okay, if this is human caused, is it human solvable? Is it actually solvable, a way to resolve this in a good way in the period of time we have in front of us?
Yeah, I mean, look, Michael, we're going to get some more warming kind of no matter what we do. But the question is, do we want to get hit in the head with a ping pong ball or a bowling ball? And that choice is up to us. So we have we can make a difference. We can avoid the biggest amounts of warming, the most destruction. But, you know, we have to prepare for a little bit different climate no matter what we do too.
Mm-hmm. And there's something you wrote in a piece that you said, every decade brings a new climate onto the planet. How does that work?
Well, we're warming the planet every decade by an amount that sets new records. I mean, you know, every couple of years you hear, well, we set a new global temperature record. Well, we set another new global temperature record. We set another new global temperature record. And pretty much every year we warm the climate by an amount that really makes it distinct and different than anything we've seen in 100,000 years or more. So we're entering a new climate regime pretty much every 10 years.
Which I'm assuming will not be reversed during the lifetime of people who are living today and maybe their grandkids and other – and they're going down the line for quite some time.
Yeah. It's really hard to reverse what's already happened. We add CO2 to the atmosphere. We add heat to the ocean. These are things that happen across And taking the carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere permanently is really, really hard to do. We can do it on a small scale, but doing it on a scale big enough to matter for the whole planet, we just haven't figured out how to do that yet. So the chances are we're stuck with what we've already done.
You were getting ready to say it. The chances are we're screwed. that's pretty much what – no, but the point is actually because this is a very critical question for people to understand and to do what they can now, because to throw our hands up and just allow the planet to be destroyed and everything in it, it's not just – you know, it's every species, everything in it is just like – it's going to be deeply impacted if not wiped out. And humanity will certainly be wiped out. And to me, there is a question of doing as much as we can to try and, one, understand what's happening and reverse it to the extent that we can, but try to figure out how to actually deal with this in a way that wouldn't mean the end of the planet.
Yeah. I mean, humans are now the primary drivers of climate change, of the changing climate. In fact, geologists have labeled this a new era, the Anthropocene, meaning the era when humans are affecting the climate. So that means we have a big choice to make, and we have a big responsibility. You know, we're making changes that are going to be there forever as far as we're concerned, and we need to be responsible about it, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm. Now, tell me this. Part of what you've been doing, I mean, OMG is – and it's funny. You named it precisely because of that name.
Right.
OMG.
OMG.
Right. But there's this other point about what that actually means and the fact that we're looking at this and I'm trying to think about like there's been stuff that you've done like this Jason project that I was really intrigued by and you are the luckiest guy I know, man. You get to go run around and do things called Jason and you're doing this, you know, and you're out there and it's very cool. But you're also really working to carry this stuff out. And this Jason project or whatever it is, I'm saying because I can't remember the full name of it, but the Jason project is really a critical aspect of understanding what's happening. And on that basis, if we understand what's happening, is there a chance to reverse this?
Yeah. So the Jason missions are a series of satellites that just measure sea level. They measure how tall the ocean is, and that tells us things about the oceans, like where the currents are going, when El Niño is happening. But it also tells us about sea level rise. So it's this indicator of our human-caused climate change footprint on the climate. And it's really important because as we look into the future, we're looking at more sea level rise, but our ability to predict how much is not so good. Right now, if you ask most experts how much sea level rise are we going to get by the end of the century, they'll say, well, somewhere between 1 foot and 7 feet. All right. That's a pretty big range. Right. And, you know, it's just because we don't really understand how the Earth is going to react to all this extra heat. And so what we're doing with things like the Jason mission and things like OMG is trying to better figure out just how big our footprint can be. And also, how much are we committed to a certain amount of sea level rise or a certain amount of warming? You know, there's this idea of climate commitment. You put so much CO2 in the atmosphere, the Earth is going to react. And how big is that reaction going to be? You know, it's kind of like asking the question, if we turned off the knob for putting CO2 in the atmosphere, how much change would we get anyway, no matter what we did? So those are things that are important for helping us make decisions about how much of an impact we want to make. But right now, we don't seem to be capable, in my opinion, of making the tough decision and deciding to turn the ship toward a more stable climate and a sustainable economy.
Do you think that's a broadly popular problem, or do you think that's actually something in terms of the kind of policy that's come out?
Well, it's the policy. I mean, I think people really are starting to get climate change. I mean, we can tell it's happening. How many giant Rhode Island size ice shelves have to break up before we say, okay, something's happening to our planet? The hard part is deciding what to do about it. And, you know, we have to do that together, and we have to do it through policy. I mean, yes, you know, you should try and reduce your carbon footprint. You should try and avoid dirty energy. Vote with your dollar. But at the end of the day, we have to have help from our leaders. And right now, in my opinion, we're not getting it.
Yeah. You think.
Right.
I mean, let's just be frank. Trump gets out there and he says – he basically in his budget that he put out there, he says, climate, yeah, you're going to do something about it? No, we're not interested.
Yeah.
You know, and that sort of portends – it basically points to a very bad direction for all of humanity.
I mean, it's frustrating to me to be having the conversation of whether or not it's happening again. We need to be talking about what we're going to do about it instead of if it exists. Mm-hmm. So I feel like certainly in the public conversation, we're kind of taking a step backwards here.
Mm-hmm. Now, tell me something real quick, because we have our next guest waiting on the line. But if you were to step back and say, okay, look, this is the most significant thing that has to be done. And if we do that, we can actually – this is what's going to set us on the path to where we need to go. And you could include, you know, getting rid of the fascist Trump. But there's also – there's more that actually needs – there's a process that needs to be done.
I mean, to me, we have to set an energy policy that rewards energy sources that don't warm up the planet and penalizes energy sources that do. We have to steer the economy and we have to steer people's choices towards more sustainable ones. Otherwise, you know, we can't leave that decision unmade, because otherwise it's just going to be driven by profits. And that's not necessarily the logical or reasonable choice.
Yeah. And that's why I believe we need a whole new system that doesn't run by profit. That's exactly what we need. You know, because, you know, really, we were talking about the El Nino and the impact of something like that and how that's related to climate change. And we ended up talking about what was going on in Greenland at that point.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, because that's how interwoven these things are. We are going to have to move on. But you're welcome to stay around, actually, if you want to hang out and listen to this. And it's, you know, that'd be good. And throw in, you know, because you're out there and you're doing all this stuff.
Thank you.
So, yeah. So I definitely want to thank you for being in today, man. I think it's very important what you're doing. And we need to stay in touch. You're going to have to become our regular climate guy.
Okay? I would love that. Thank you,
right.
Michael.
All right, Josh Willis. Thank you very much for joining us today. We're going to take a quick musical break and we'll be right back, talking with Brant Olson, Executive Director of ClimateTruth.org, and he's one of the people who's been assisting in organizing the March for Science coming up, so stay tuned. Welcome back. That was Thievery Corporation with Babylon Falling. Yes, Babylon Falling. And it's melting as well. So listen, we're going to be joining Brant Olson in just a second, but I sort of lassoed Josh Willis to stay behind and just tell me. So, Mr. Willis, are you going to be at the march this month?
Yes, Michael, I am going to march. I'm going to exercise my right to speak up in favor of science. You know, I think we're at a moment when science needs a voice to say, hey, this is important, not even because of the political spectrum, but science is important to our everyday lives. It's one of the ways we figure out what's true. Mm-hmm. And I think that's an important message.
All right, Josh. Thanks a lot, man. And now you can run out the door and I'll talk to you later, man. I'm going to take that tour, the whole JPL thing that's going to be.
I'm looking forward to it, Michael.
Right,
thanks so much.
Take care now. All right. Now, I'm really pleased to welcome to the show Brant Olson. Brant, how are you?
I'm doing good. Thanks very much.
Good, good, good. And I should tell people that you are the executive director of ClimateTruth.org, a group that helped organize the Stand Up for Science rally, and is assisting in the March for Science. We're going to talk today about the March for Science on April 22nd in Washington, D.C., and as well as other parts of the country, satellite marches in over 430 other cities. That's correct?
Yeah, hundreds all over the world.
That's great, man. That's really great. Now, tell me this. The March for Science, just for people who might not know, what is it and what gave rise to it?
Well, you know, it's one of those things that could only happen with the internet. Shortly after the Trump administration started sending out letters asking for the names of folks within government that were working on climate change, scientists got understandably worried and started taking action. And this started as an idea on Reddit, an online kind of community, and grew like crazy and almost overnight. So at this point, you know, there's more than 1 million people that are following along on Facebook and Twitter and elsewhere. And as you just mentioned, you know, more than 400 marches organized all over the world. So pretty clear response from the science community saying that they're not going to be pushed around.
Yeah, that was kind of an out of the lab and into the streets response that developed among scientists. And that was really phenomenal, I think.
Yeah, I mean, it, as I say, only with the internet. More than a million people mobilized virtually overnight. This is really just an organic response, I think, to some real threats to science that are being posed by Trump and his friends in Congress.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you're talking about the March for Science, people are going to want to know, well, what exactly? Can you tell us something specifically? What is the specific program that it might stand for? And it doesn't have to be, you know, step by step, but what's the overall program that the March for Science is advocating?
Well, I think it's really advocating to resist the legal wrecking ball that the Trump administration has taken to science and the planet. Some things that have already been done in terms of cabinet appointments with Scott Pruitt as head of the EPA, with an oil company executive appointed to the State Department. I mean, this is really about an evisceration of all of the various supports that exist within our government for basic things like research into disease, into climate change. And so the march is about people standing up against that and in favor of science-based policymaking. So that's why we're coming out into the street.
Mm-hmm. Now, there's something I read recently that made that point in this way, which said, while the march is explicitly nonpartisan, it is political. And that was said by one of the organizers of the march. And I wanted to actually see if you could explain that for people.
Sure. Well, I mean, this isn't not a Republican issue. It's not a Democrat issue by any means. We've got folks that are going to be turning out and folks that are organizing from across the political spectrum. But what this is about is making sure that science continues to be the foundation on which we build our policy. So institutions such as NOAA and NASA and the National Institutes of Health, these are all services of our government that study, you know, the natural world, that study biology, that study the causes and consequences of disease and keep us healthy. And when you start defunding those institutions, you start eroding that foundation on which good policy is made. And ultimately, that means that our communities are going to suffer. It means that we can't defend ourselves from disease outbreak. We can't defend ourselves from the ravages of climate change.
Mm-hmm. I want to remind listeners that this is the Michael Slate Show, and I'm speaking with Brant Olson, Executive Director of ClimateTruth.org, a group that helped organize the Stand Up for Science rally, and we're talking about the March for Science, which Brant is helping to organize. And it really is true, that point about a government that ignores all this, that ignores science in general, but especially in relation to all this, it endangers the world overall and everything in it and everyone in it. That's a fairly important thing for people to keep in mind.
Right. And scientists, I think, and I've talked with hundreds over the course of our work on this, don't tend to view themselves as especially political. You know, they want to be in their laboratories. They want to be doing their work. And they don't necessarily want to be, you know, shouting in the megaphone or protesting on the street. But it's come to such a threat level that that's necessary. Just doing the science isn't enough at this point. It's really up to scientists and those that support science, believe in science, to mobilize, because it's under real substantial threat, really an unprecedented threat in terms of the history of the United States.
Mm-hmm. You know, when you say that about an unprecedented threat, are there things you could expand on in that along that vein? I mean, something you would be able to say to people, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, so the government agencies that I just mentioned, let's take, for example, the EPA. The Environmental Protection Agency, Trump has proposed cutting the budget by a third, laying off thousands of people from the department. Scott Pruitt, the head of the EPA, made a career out of bringing litigation to stop enforcement of basic programs that protect our communities. So those are the types of threats that we're pushing back against. We need a strong EPA in order to preserve species, in order to be sure that we have healthy, clean water to drink, that we have clean air to breathe. And by, you know, cutting the agency back, which I should say is already, you know, doesn't have the funds that needs to fulfill its purpose, you know, we're really dealing a blow back to our communities. That's the point, that science isn't just for science's sake. Science isn't about just sort of testing things because you're curious, although that's a big part of it. It's about protecting our communities, and that's what Trump and company are really going after.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, it's interesting. Carolyn Weinberg, who is one of the people who was involved in this from the very beginning, she made the statement that the point of science is getting to the truth and helping us understand the world. And acting as though this has no role in politics is absolutely ridiculous. That was a fairly important statement for somebody to make in this period. And true.
Yeah, it's absolutely true. And I think obviously there's a lot of different opinion and debate across on this across the science community. But I think a positive sign that we've seen is a lot of the biggest scientific organizations sort of taking a step and stepping up and becoming more vocal on these issues. So folks like the Academy of Sciences here in the U.S. and the American Geophysical Union, geologists, right, the largest geophysical science organization in the country, are now, you know, asking their members and their supporters to mobilize and support these marches. So I think, you know, the science community as a whole is beginning to recognize that science is political. And in order to preserve science, we need to get active politically. We need to hold our elected officials accountable.
And actually, some of this is important in terms of how this is spread. I mean, it's been very interesting. One thing, it's one thing to have it happen here, and it's very encouraging and very good and very important that people are standing up against this Nazi that's in the White House. At the same time, this has become very much an international thing as well. That's been a pretty significant development, right?
Yeah, yeah. And I think, you know, the world has looked to the United States for a long time to kind of set the bar in terms of what solid science looks like. And the government has been an important source of support for science ongoing, you know, here in the United States and abroad. And so when you have Rex Tillerson, you know, the former CEO of ExxonMobil, representing the United States interests abroad, his interests certainly, you know, do not relate to science. I mean, if you look at the history of ExxonMobil, they knew as early as the late 70s about the basic science behind climate change. And instead of changing their business model to respond to the threats posed by climate change and the, caused by the emissions of fossil fuels, ExxonMobil doubled down and, you know, essentially funded a multi-decade effort to undermine science. So that doesn't give, you know, a lot of confidence to those who are interested in spreading science throughout the world that that's going to happen moving forward, because the folks who are in charge have made a career out of undermining the basic science behind climate change in the case of Rex Tillerson.
Mm-hmm. And when you add into that the whole question of the U.S. military and its role in terms of its impact, its negative impact on the climate through the use of oil, the biggest user of oil in the entire universe, you know, and that's not changing anytime soon. Brandt, I want to thank you very much for joining us today. Is there anything else you'd like to add before we go?
Well, just to pitch the how to get involved. So visit marchforscience.com to get sort of the whole global picture. Thanks for having me on.
Sure. And we'll stay in touch, okay?
Okay.
All right. Take care, man. Bye now. And for information on the March for Science, it's Earth Day, April 22nd. Go to marchforscience.com as well. You can also find satellite marches. There are 32 marches in California alone, sisters and brothers. Now, there's a number of important demonstrations that have been scheduled beginning the second part of April, going right up against some of the most hateful policies of the Trump-Pence regime. These demonstrations include the April 22nd March for Science, the April 29th People's Climate March, and the May 1st protests against the attacks on immigrants. In a statement released on April 2nd, Refuse Fascism endorsed these demonstrations and called for mass contingents of many thousands of people under the banner of No, in the name of humanity, we refuse to accept the fascist America. Drive out the Trump-Pence regime. And again, you can go to the site revcom.us, and you'll see this right on the front page of the site, or go to Revolution Newspaper inside the site, and you can read all about the campaign, Drive Out the Trump-Pence Regime, and find out how you can become part of it. So once again, those websites are refusefascism.org and revcom.us for news, to find out how to get involved, and much, much more. Now, there's something I wanted to read. There's an important article on revcom.us. Once again, it's revcom.us, and it's called No Time for Celebration. The Trump-Pence juggernaut remains on a roll and must be driven out. You can find the link on my Facebook page. The article begins this way. The past 2 weeks have spun by at a dizzying pace. Trump's new anti-Muslim ban was instituted and quickly blocked by federal district court judges. The hearings on possible ties between the Trump camp and Russia leading into the elections opened. And then on Friday, the Republican health care bill was defeated. All of these were actual setbacks for the regime. But to put it bluntly, This raft of difficulties and setbacks does not necessarily signify that the regime has suffered or will soon suffer mortal blows. In fact, as the article goes on to show, they are still moving very quickly to hammer a fascist form of rule into place. And I really recommend that people check out the full article at revcom.us. No time for celebration, and check out the important events coming up in April and May when hundreds of thousands or more will be in the streets. That just about does it for the show this week. I want to thank all of my guests. I want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, and my board op for today, Kiana Williams. And she's my board op for all the time, for eternity. All right. And we'll talk to you again next week.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.